It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. We've got a great show for you. Brianna Wu is here from the Big Technology Podcast and Newsletter. Alex Kantrowitz. We will talk a little bit about Elon and Twitter, but there's a lot more to talk about, including why tech stocks are crashing and burning, why Bitcoin and NFTs are losing steam, how the last 10 years of American life has been uniquely stupid. We'll talk about protecting your privacy online. Yeah, and which browser does it best? Plus, some big fines for some big companies. Our new This Is Fine segment. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit. This Week in Tech, episode 874, recorded May 8th, 2022. Malicious compliance. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by UserWay.org. UserWay is the world's number one accessibility solution, and it's committed to enabling the fundamental human right of digital accessibility for everyone. When you're ready to make your site compliant, deciding which solution to use is an easy choice to make. Go to userway.org/twit for 30% off UserWay's AI-powered accessibility solution. And by Worldwide Technology and Cisco. With an innovative culture, thousands of IT engineers, application developers, unmatched labs, and integration centers for testing and deploying technology at scale, WWT helps customers bridge the gap between strategy and execution. To learn more about WWT, visit wwt.com/twit. And by Mint Mobile. Those big wireless providers forget that families come in all shapes and sizes. That's why Mint Mobile decided to shake up the wireless industry with their brand new modern family plan. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, including the modern family plan, go to mintmobile.com/twit. And by Policy Genius. If someone relies on your financial support, whether it's a child, aging parent, or even a business partner, you need life insurance. Head to policygenius.com/twit to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. It's time for Twit. This Week in Tech, the show we cover with the latest tech news. We had too many people in the show last week, so this week we're going to have too few. No, I think this is going to be just right. Brianna Wu is here. Hello, Brianna Wu from the Rebellion Pack. Gaming designer, woman about town, former...
Marathoner, Porsche collector.
Wait a minute, marathoner.
Just take your pick.
Is that new? Long marathons, short marathons?
Oh, no. I have actually, Leo, I hope this isn't too personal to share, but I was looking at the calendar this week, and I've spent 20 years sober. And a big reason of how I got sober was learning to run every single day.
Nice. Running away from your demons.
It keeps you healthy, right? Yeah. It just keeps me all balanced.
Hey, that's great.
Yep, I've been doing that for a long time.
And congratulations on the
thank you on the
20-year chip. Also with us, Alex Kantrowitz, Mr. Big Tech. He's the newsletter's bigtechnology.substack.com. He does the Big Technology Podcast. Always great to see you, Alex. Thank you for being here.
Great to see you, Leo. Great to be here. It's awesome to be here. Thank you for having me.
This book about Amazon, Always Day One. On finer newsstands everywhere.
We got all the tech giants in there, but mostly Amazon. Well, but yeah, if you're a Microsoft person, then pick it up anyway.
Yeah, that's right. It all counts. It all matters.
They've gone from day two to day one, so credit to them.
I know. I can feel it that there are people in the audience going, please don't let him talk about Elon. Please don't let him talk about Elon. This has been for the last 3 weeks. That's all.
Oh.
And we're all sick of it. I completely understand. The only news here is that Elon is going around trying to raise the money. His stake in buying Twitter of the $44 billion is $21 billion, which even though he's – and this is an important lesson for all you youngsters. Even though he's the richest man in the world with an estimated net worth of $270 billion, he doesn't have two nickels to rub together. So he is going to bankers – I think he's got like 7 billion, you know, just a few billion. So he's going to bankers to get the rest of it. And so he's got a deck, you know, a PowerPoint. Although with Elon, I doubt it's a PowerPoint. He's probably using something spacey like Prezi. But he's got something that he's going around saying, let me explain to you why I would be, you know, you should give me money for Twitter. And
have you seen these slides yet, Leo? Because they are crazy. There was one that came out today showing Elon's forecasts for Twitter.
Insane.
Like crazy pants. There's no way he's going to quadruple the number of people on Twitter. And I know venture capitalists are used to seeing optimistic projections, but this is not like someone working out of their college dorm. This is Elon Musk. So
not paragon of...
Yes.
Strict financial accuracy, perhaps. You wrote a great piece, Alex, based on Alex Redder, who once ran Twitter engineering, on evaluating Elon's plans to fix Twitter. It's probably good to ask somebody who's actually at Twitter what they think. And what did that Alex think?
It was interesting. So we did it as a podcast on Big Technology Podcast, and I wrote up in the newsletter. My voice was totally shot. I had probably COVID light or whatever it was. But anyway, it was really interesting to speak to someone who had run engineering at Twitter and then ask them what their perspective is on all these ideas that Elon's been bringing up. There are some good ones in there. I think the idea to authenticate every human is really interesting. Twitter hasn't done that previously because it's a public company and it has to show user growth. And if they were going to say, if you want to be on Twitter, you got to use a phone number or an email address to be here, they would lose lots of people. So they just never did it. And so having a private, having private ownership actually gives them the ability to do this without the scrutiny and the disaster to the stock that Wall Street would bring. So
EFF has said very clearly that anonymity, which is often offered, as a panacea for social networks to eliminate anonymity, has A, never succeeded, and B, poses all sorts of issues for people who have good reason to want to communicate without giving away their true identity. So I think on the surface, authentication sounds reasonable. Brianna, do you have an opinion on that? I would imagine you do.
I have an opinion on everything in your piece, Alex. And a lot of this is actually informed from my own experience working with Twitter. When this was announced, I did interviews with New York Times,
for people who don't
NBC
know.
NBC Nightly Knows, everybody about this. So, yeah.
Wait a minute, NBC Nightly Knows? I have
missing
that one.
News.
I'm going to have to watch
that one. My basement flooded last night. So I've had about 4 hours
okay.
of sleep.
No, it's good. I like the Nightly Knows, and yes, I'd like to watch it. No, but you have been the target of horrific trolling on Twitter.
Sure,
you were forced to move out of your house during Gamergate. So people should know that you know a little bit about how bad it could be.
So more specifically though, Leo, something I did was I finally disclosed this about 3 weeks ago. I've actually worked very closely with Twitter's trust and safety team over most of the things in your article, Alex. So, when Elon is saying, I want to fix this, the reality is there's actually a huge long history of Twitter working to fix this from behind the scenes. So kind of starting at the top of this, like making sure people are real. This is something Twitter actually spent quite a bit of time working on from 2014 to about 2018. Because the problem was someone would do a death threat account, it would get suspended, and then all these 4chan, 8chan sock puppets would just zerg the site over and over again, creating new accounts. So Twitter actually did a ton of work locking down IP addresses and actually requiring you after a certain point to start giving a phone number if the same IP address was trying to register another Twitter account. I want to note that those restrictions have been largely lifted at Twitter in the last 3 years. I agree with this, but I think Elon doing that would be reinstating a policy that, frankly, the board took down, I assume, because it impeded growth at the company.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the advantage, right? Is that he doesn't have to show growth. The board was accountable to shareholders. Elon will be the number one person making decision. Of course, he'll have investors and he wants to take it public again. But
he
I
says
think there
in
are
three
some
years,
good things.
He's going to make it public again. I honestly think that's part of the deck just because nobody's going to lend him money if there's if there's not a clear path to profitability, Twitter has been 15 years trying to make money and failed in every respect. So I understand why he put that in. It's kind of like Michael Dell. He took Dell private. We talked about this last week. And then a few years later went public. And it's worth a hell of a lot more now. So that's a reasonable thing.
Yeah. And the whole appeal of investing with Elon is he turns your stock into a meme stock.
Into gold.
Because there are online hordes of people that want to invest with him. And actually, I was surprised.
Would you put money if Elon came to you? And let's say you had $100 million lying around. Would you give him $100 million and say, yeah, you can double my money?
On Twitter, no. On other things, for sure. Not on Twitter.
Therein lies the problem. Twitter is tough. Twitter's tough.
It's super hard, but...
Yeah,
I mean, the guy just said, I don't care about the economics of this business.
But that's what's interesting.
And ask me for $100 million. No way am I.
But that's what's interesting because
I'll spend the money on something that he cares about the economics of.
Yeah. Well, now all of a sudden he kind of cares about the economics because this deck he's going around showing how the road to profitability because no one's going to lend him money. So suddenly he does care because he has to raise this money, right? So part of the problem with Elon is. It's impossible to know what he's actually planning.
You know, he has the deck because he wants the money, but I tend to listen to the guy, you know, in his own words. He said it multiple times.
So you would not
This is
money.
Not about a business. Not on Twitter. On SpaceX and Tesla, you know, absolutely. but not on Twitter. You know, I would sooner lend Elon money to dig tunnels in LA than I would to have him run Twitter.
Yeah.
Not to say he's going to do a bad job. I just think
so
that
it'd be
this
foolish
from a
for
business
him.
Perspective is wrong.
And it certainly
is a bad investment.
It's Twitter's right to enforce authentication, and it would certainly make it a better place. And there are other places people who need anonymity can go. So, yeah, I mean, if you don't care about making money, if you don't care about losing people, he says free speech, but spam is not. Is a free speech. I mean, spam is protected speech.
And this is one of the things that I spoke with Alex Redder about.
Yeah, what did he say?
Basically said, you can, so if you, one of Elon's number one things he wants to do is build is to get rid of the spam bots. To do that, you build a classifier that says, okay, there is spam here. There's no spam there. So let's do what we can to wipe out the spam on the site.
Right.
The thing is that like you turn a dial. So you can make it like a weak classifier and basically say, or the classifier, you could turn it weak and say, you know, we'll allow for complete or as close to free speech as we can. And we're going to get a couple of bots, or you're going to say we want to nuke the bots, but then you're going to get humans when you're trying, because the classifier is going to be like, that looks kind of bot-like.
So the same problem as spam email, right? Which we have not yet perfected.
For sure. Yeah.
So if I could just say something.
Personal bugaboo of mine, right. Spam email with a newsletter, man, it's tough.
Yep.
Go ahead.
If I could just add something here. First of all, I just want to pause and say, I think we're falling in like agreeing that Elon wants free speech here. I don't agree with that assessment here. He wants to roll back anti-harassment policies, and that, I think, curtails speech for a lot of people. So I just want to say I don't agree with that framing. Coming back to the bot issue, again, this is something I've very specifically worked with Twitter on for years. I would say throughout 2016 to 2017, I probably did between 50 and 100 hours of work compiling bots that were actually dedicated for harassment of various people online and collating this information, sending it over to Twitter to try to get their engineers to cut down on this harassment bot. I know that Twit as an organization has dealt with a lot of these harassment bots. It did get better for a while, but again, the money men stepped in and kind of twisted those dials in a way because they wanted more engagement. Something I noted in a lot of the interviews I did over the last few weeks was what happened is from 2014 to about 2017, these policies had a lot of support from Jack and Twitter as a whole. But then once Trump was elected, many of these policies became another stupid right versus left screaming match. So it wasn't normal professionals versus the trolls. It was the right versus left. And from my experience, I saw a lot of the will to really address these things at Twitter start to go away. And I've personally seen a lot of those safeguards against bots really get rolled backwards. Coming back to one additional point, you're talking about making Twitter private and how that can have good things. Something I think is really under-discussed is no one goes to work at a major tech company without stock options. My own husband is in biotech. Stock options are a non-trivial part of how people in that industry are paid, or Microsoft, or Google, or Apple. And if this is a private company, I think it's a real open question how you're going to continue to attract talent if that is not a steady part of your compensation package.
That's another confusing thing that Elon's done, which is said, I'm going to fire a bunch of people so that we can improve expenses, and then I'm going to hire a bunch more people. He's planning to really expand the number of employees at Twitter, and that's going to be hard to do without stock options, without compensation.
Yeah. Isn't it going to be interesting when Elon gets in there and he's faced with some of these contradictions? Like, he's going to be the one that's faced with, like, do you take the spam bots down, or do you allow for basically people to say whatever they want on the platform? I do think, you know, in terms of stock, I don't think Elon's going to have any issue getting people to work for him. A, there's like just the Elon halo that a lot of people working in tech would like to be around. And B, he's basically going to make it into, if he's planning to go, it's true. It's true. You know, whether I'm a fan
he's
of
such
it or
a
not,
polarizing it's figure. It's so interesting. You but love remember, him or you hate him, but I will there's stipulate there is a bunch of people that love him that will do it.
And,
yeah,
and,
I agree.
And then, you know, he's essentially going to turn Twitter. I mean, we'll see what he can do with options and stuff like that. But he's essentially going to turn Twitter into like one of the most high profile startups that we have, you know, in the tech world, where it's going to be 3-4 years, bring it public again. You know, maybe people working on the private version of Twitter then have an optionality
to
buy in to the second IPO.
Yeah. If he says he's going to quintuple revenue. You know, 500%.
Well, that's not going to happen. I mean, maybe
I have to disagree with that, though. What makes Twitter this is why I don't agree with you. I think that's right if you want to attract white male engineers in the field. I 100% agree with you. There are a ton of Elon Musk cultists out there that hang on his every word and would love to go work for him. What I am personally seeing with women and people of color and LGBT people that I know that work in Silicon Valley is there's more of a stigma to working with him than Zuckerberg. And that's a non-trivial bar. And I think this affects the end product in a lot of ways. If you're talking about something like Coinbase and attracting a very certain kind of person there, ultimately it's more of a financial product. I believe Twitter will live or die based on the harassment policies. There are a lot of people that leave Twitter because they just throw up their hands and say, I can't deal with the death threats, the rape threats, the harassment, the doxing, the armies of sock puppets calling me names anymore. And, you know, it's not the Musk cultists that are going to be able to address that. It is women, it is people of color, it is LGBT people that care about these issues. So if you're subtly showing them the door, I just don't agree with you that Twitter is going to be able to find the people that needs to solve those problems.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I don't think that you can find disagreement with me on that one. I do think that there's a good chance that Twitter ends up becoming worse because of this. However, like, he is going to be able to find, you know, people to work. Twitter's going in a different direction right now. And I definitely don't think that there's going to be a lot of Democrats or liberals that are going to want to work with Elon, especially if you look at what he's tweeting. And the question is, can he, you know, it's a big financial investment for him. Can he get his money out, you know, without wrecking the company, without wrecking society? And that's sort of the experiment we're going to see with Elon over the next couple of years in Twitter, assuming the deal goes through.
If Twitter, that's right. It may not. We still don't know. Let's say we need something besides, do we need something like Twitter? Do we need Twitter? And is there an alternative that people could flock to if they didn't want to be on Twitter? Let's start with the first one. Do we need something like Twitter? How important is it?
We don't need it, but it is just part of the internet experience. Now, I mean, it is in many ways the beating heart of the internet. I think that what Jack Dorsey called it, the collective consciousness, or the closest thing we have
Elon
to a collective consciousness.
Public square,
You know, I think that it's the closest. It's the closest thing we have. Is Twitter real life? Definitely not. You know, we should all remember that Twitter only has 217 million monthly active users. Right. It's a tiny portion of the population. Right. I personally like the product. Is it going to be a loss? It will survive if there's no Twitter. It's not like it's oxygen for us. But there will always be something real time, live, focused on news on the internet. It's just a fact of the internet. And right now, Twitter serves that role.
Brianna, which would you give up, Facebook or Twitter?
Well, I think Facebook, like if you look at the grand scheme of harm to the world, I think Facebook is worse, right? Like yeah. Twitter is not responsible yeah. for, you know, say a genocide, which Facebook has been. So, you know, for me, this is a perspective I would ask you guys to consider. So take the game industry, which I used to work in. In the game industry, a lot of men just naturally network with each other. Right. So when I was first getting started in games, I would go to bars after work and try to meet important people in that field to form the connections that my game studio would need. Right. So a bunch of dudes drinking at a bar, and they would ask my husband if he's the engineer. Right. My yeah. husband can't.
You couldn't possibly be. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So my message to you is Twitter, from my experience, has been a vital networking tool. As far as like my current boss, I met my boss because he was getting chased by a Twitter mob and I stood up to him for wow. him. Wow. And, you know, there are any number of just really close friends and professional connections that I've got there. If you're talking about Twitter going away, I really do think this is a place for women and people of color to network. And I think that's really undervalued in the discussion about this. What I think is very interesting is, to me, the key feature of Twitter that it's missing is a really big investment in trust and safety. And if I were working on that trust and safety team and Elon Musk was taking over, I personally would go straight down to the venture capitalists and say, look, give me, this is not that complicated a product, right? Give me $200-300 million. Let me develop something that truly puts trust and safety first. Not to say everyone doesn't have a voice, but we're going to get rid of the death and rape threats. That's garbage. It doesn't add anything into the dialogue. And I can really see something like that taking off and really succeeding. I would move there in a heartbeat. And I think a lot of other journalists would too.
You sound convinced that it's possible.
I think so. I think App.net failed, but I think Dalton had, just to remind your listeners, App.net was this $50 a month paid Twitter service that was open source. It's very similar to what they're doing now. But there was never a push to develop a really good first tier client for that. I think if you had someone that just wanted one client, they weren't trying to, you know, develop like 50 different Twitter services, and just focused on trust and safety. I think that's a product a lot of people would use.
I agree with Brianna here.
Go ahead.
I'll just say quickly that like Twitter was founded in March 2006. So it's been around for 16 years. The human history has far outpaced, you know, that amount of time. And I think we're just at the beginning of the social internet.
Right.
And so you look at that and you ask a question, can Twitter, you know, be usurped eventually? Not only do I think it's possible, I think it's likely. And the question is what the product is. It's what we have now. But 100 years down the road, are we going to be all on Twitter yelling at each other?
No.
I mean, I think that's unlikely.
Yeah.
And I think that's the beauty of having a market, right? If Elon goes in and breaks Twitter, there becomes an opening to build something different. Like Brianna's talking about, or maybe there'll be many different takes and let the best system win.
Yeah.
And I think that's cool.
Do you think though, it's interesting. You said Brianna, $300 million and I could build a safe place. So something like Mastodon, an open source federated solution. There's not anywhere near that kind of money to make a safe place. So you think it's going to take some big commercial entity to do it?
I do. And I want to be really clear here. I'm not talking about a safe space. I'm talking about a place where anyone can express their opinions without getting death threats, rape threats, doxing, bots, you know, defiling their reputation online. I mean, I'm talking about a place where everyone can have free speech, to be really clear. I think the problem is,
see, you know, these products by the way, it's important to point out your definition of free speech is different than Elon's. Yeah. Elon's is anything goes as long as it's not illegal. But you're saying right. That's not really free because then there are a bunch of people who can't speak freely because they'll be immediately shouted down.
That's exactly right. I think the problem is with a lot of these products, you know, all respect to my engineer friends, but sometimes we're a little idealist about this. And you're like, look, you can just go run your own Mastodon instance and do all this free moderation work in your spare time and get everyone to download a client. It's going to be great. Yet the reality is things like Discord catch on, like a very straightforward, well-coded solution. So I don't think it's that complicated. Twitter, but with real money and trust and safety. I think that's what people want.
Well, it's interesting.
And we're also,
maybe Elon, also instead of trying to buy Twitter, should have just spent half that money or a tenth of that amount of money and built something.
But that money can build something if Elon ruins it. So it's almost like he's opening up, you know, you need people. Like, this is a content driven app. Yeah. And you need people to be able to go.
So that's the problem, the network effect.
Somebody to ruin it,
yeah,
in order to be able to build a competitor. It's not a very technically complex product, let's be honest. So to be able to build something else for 300, it would be okay. You'd build the bones of it, but then you'd hire the trust and safety and say, I could do better. But you would need someone to ruin Twitter proper in order to do it. Also, I think one last thing about this, we're talking a lot about free speech. I also think that there's real credibility to the free speech versus freedom of reach distinction. And this is a thing that I'm on the high horse about, or the hill that I'll die on, you know, for the remainder of the social media discussion, is that, you know, you can allow people to say whatever you want, whatever they want. You don't need to allow them to be able to get amplified by the algorithms, show up in people's mentions. And so it's very possible to create a Twitter that there is, you know, quote unquote free speech, but one that doesn't, you know, necessarily. Twitter is, the algorithm is an editor. So the editor doesn't need to give promotion to the horrible things that people say. That it's making decisions every day. So it's the free speech is such a limited window to look at it.
So Elon has raised about $5.2 billion toward his goals so far. 18 investors, 35 million shares rolled over from Saudi Prince Awaleed bin Talal, which always makes me nervous when I see investments from Saudi. But unfortunately, that's a kind of the way it is in Silicon Valley. $1 billion from Larry Ellison, $800 million from Sequoia Capital, $700 million from Vi Capital, $500 million from Binance, $400 million from Andreessen Horowitz. So that $100 million I was asking you for, Alex, he's found a few people to hand over even more.
If Elon was really smart, he would, put his $42 billion into Twitter and then give Brianna maybe $300 million to build the alternate.
So
he could kind of hedge there and be like, listen, if I ruin this, now I own half of this platform.
Well, there is, in a way, there is something going on like that, because before Jack Dorsey left Twitter, he funded, I think, $54 million, funded Blue Sky, which is an R&D project to create a federated open source Twitter. That funding has already been awarded to Blue Sky. It can't be taken away by anybody, including Elon. So there is a group going forward with something that was considered by the former Twitter CEO and one of its founders to be the future of Twitter, Blue Sky. So maybe there is an alternative in the works. I don't know.
That's going to get so caught up with this Web3 stuff. I really am. I think that's been Jack's focus recently. I do want to come back to something we were talking about, which was the investment here and how Elon is going to pay for it. Because I think this is really a bigger discussion here. If you look at Elon's, Tesla stock, before I say this, I want to stress, I want EVs to win. The day Porsche puts out an electric Boxster will be the day I buy it. I've already talked to my dude. He will have me first in line for it. I want EVs to win. But I would urge anyone to go out and look at the price to earnings ratio of Tesla and the amount of money they actually make versus what their stock price is, which is, it's so many more times the rest of the industry. It is ludicrous. It just makes no sense from like an objective stock market perspective. Like, what can you make?
Stock, isn't it? Yeah.
It's crazy. So, you know, for a while I did the thing on Robinhood where I was just waiting for Elon to tweet about some, you know, meme stock and a meme, you know, Bitcoin or whatever, and I would buy a bunch of it. And I was looking, I made a fair amount of money last year just doing that. At the same time, I think if you're looking at Tesla and how he's actually going to buy Tesla, because the tech stock market has taken such a beating, I think that's the real reason he's taking on all the rest of these private investors who are going to want to be paid back. Some of these people that he's, you know, working with on this don't have a great track record when it comes to social media. App.net, I've already mentioned. When's the last time you heard about Clubhouse or went on there? You know, there are real concerns here about, you know, how he's going to pay for it and what the long-term viability of this is going to be. So just consider me extremely skeptical about every bit of this endeavor, especially financially.
It's really fascinating to watch. We live in a kind of a different kind of gilded age where we have these very, very wealthy people, and they're able to do things, some of them like SpaceX and Tesla maybe, really are benefiting the world. Some of them not. But it's really, it's not in the hands of the people what where this money goes. It's in the hands of whatever these guys decide is important. And I'm not sure I fully trust these oligarchs to make those decisions, to be honest with you. I don't know if they're the best people to be doing that.
But it's also the benefit of being in a capitalist system. Like if they mess it up, someone else can come in and build something better and go to it.
True. It'll be interesting to watch. All right. I said we weren't going to do any Elon, but I'd have to tell you, the next couple of years, there's going to be a lot of Elon in the tech news, and rightly so. It's fascinating. And of course, there's always been Twitter's always had a kind of an outsized interest for those of us in the tech media. I mean, it has a lot of influence. We pay a lot of attention to it, even though the rest of the world may not. And I guess that's why we care a lot about what happens to Twitter. We live in interesting times. Our show today brought to you by userway.org. Watch. Userway.org. I'm talking about making your website ADA compliant, accessible. Not only is it the right thing to do, because you're opening up your website to a much larger group, 60 million plus people, you have a responsibility to make your site accessible. It's a public entity, so you got to make it accessible. And with UserWay, it's easy. That was my biggest concern was, oh, I can't afford it or it's going to be too hard. No, UserWay is really affordable and it's really easy. It's AI powered. It tirelessly enforces all the accessibility guidelines, the WCAG, WCAG guidelines. And I love this. So do our engineers. It's one line of JavaScript. That's it. Because UserWay is so good, it's used by more than a million websites, including the big guys, Coca-Cola, Disney, eBay. These are companies that really have to be accessible, and UserWay can do that. As you get bigger, they scale with you. If they can handle Disney, absolutely they can handle you. They make best-in-class, enterprise-level accessibility tools available to you, your small or medium-sized business. And then as you scale, you need UserWay, and you're ready. It just makes business sense. Some of the biggest problems, nav menus, very difficult. So the way this works, if you're blind or you're using accessibility tools, there is what they call an accessibility layer. That's what the screen reader sees. So really what UserWay does is make sure that all the information available to the front page to the sighted user is available to the browser in the accessibility layer. It changes colors. Now, you've got your Pantone color for your business. Of course, we do too. It doesn't change that. But it adjusts hue and luminance so it's easier for people with vision issues to read. So UserWay will generate alt tags. That's one of the reasons it needs AI. It can actually see the picture and generate an alt tag that matches the picture automatically. You can go in if you want. You can modify it, of course. It fixes violations like vague links, fixes broken links, makes sure that your website uses accessible colors. And you'll get a detailed report of all the violations that were fixed on your website so you know exactly what it did. Plus, you can work with it. UserWay integrates seamlessly with your site builder software. Let UserWay help your business meet its compliance goals, improve the experience for your users. UserWay can make any website fully accessible, ADA compliant, and everyone who visits can browse seamlessly, customize it to fit their needs. It's a great way to show your brand's commitment to the millions of people with disabilities. It's the right thing to do. UserWay can make any website fully accessible and ADA compliant. Just look at the bottom of twit.tv in the lower right-hand corner. You'll see the UserWay icon, and you can see just with one line of code how it's transformed our website. With UserWay, everyone who visits the site can browse seamlessly, can customize it to fit their needs. It's also a perfect way to showcase your brand's commitment to millions of people with disabilities. You don't want to leave them out, right? Go to userway.org/twit. You'll get 30% off UserWay's AI-powered accessibility solution right now. UserWay, making the internet accessible for everyone. UserWay.org/twit. UserWay.org/twit. Thank you, UserWay. And thank you, viewers and listeners. Now you can come back. We're not going to talk about Elon anymore. We're not going to talk about Twitter anymore. Although I honestly could spend hours doing it. It's just somehow endlessly fascinating to me. Stocks have become fascinating to a lot of people. Big NASDAQ drop in tech stocks. Alex, you cover big tech. So obviously you're covering, you know, to some degree, the tech stock prices. Is this a reflection of some deeper problem with big tech, or is this just the usual financial market fluctuation?
I don't think this is a problem with big tech fundamentally. I think what we're seeing now is what I think is a perfect storm of a number of really challenging factors hitting tech all at the same time. I mean, just to quickly list them, you have the Fed raising interest rates, which deprioritizes growth and prioritizes current profits. And we all know that, you know, the valuations of tech are much more about what they can do in the future because they have the ability to grow, you know, in a faster way than, let's say, like, you know, a brick and mortar store. So that's number one. I think that's one of the biggest issues. It's caused a total re-rating of the valuations of these companies. Number two is the Ukraine war. You know, you take a look at companies like Netflix, right, which pulled out of Russia, lost a million subscribers, posted their first, you know, subscriber loss based off of that alone. It's also hit Facebook and Snap. I think those are big issues. The supply chain is still a mess. So any company that's going to sell based off of ads on these platforms is now starting to rethink it and trying to figure out, hey, how do I handle this? Inflation is, you know, going to cause people to change the way that they spend. And it goes on and on. And I think that when you have all this hitting at the same time, it has taken a lot of the air out of the market, which, like, let's be honest, the market was not exactly running on the fundamentals for the last couple of years. And now it is.
So this is if this sell-off actually makes sense, it sounds like.
Yeah, to me, the thing that didn't make sense was the run-up on tech stocks over the last couple of years.
Right.
You know,
some of that was pandemic, COVID, though, right? Yeah, pandemic.
That's where I was going. Is the pandemic going to change the way that Amazon does business, Facebook does business? You know, companies like Amazon. Oh, well, we said Amazon. But Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, you know, Zoom. Of course it is. Netflix, yes, definitely. And we're still seeing massive gains that haven't gone away for these companies. But the market, I don't know exactly what happened. For some reason, investors got carried away here and thought that this is the way that we were just going to be living forever. And I think in the middle of a COVID fog, it's possible to think that we're going to be living in the COVID, you know, lifestyle forever, which means, of course, Netflix should be, you know, $1,000 a share, you know, versus what it is now, right? $199 this last time I checked. It got up to around $700. But you know, it's obviously just not the case. We were always going to go back into the worlds. Same thing happened to people like on Clubhouse, right? They thought we were just going to be on Clubhouse, you know, forever. And then the first night we're out, able to go out for dinner, you know, that goes away. Yeah. And so, like, earth to investors, like, we, you know, you got to think beyond. And it's a good thing. You know, you got to think beyond, like, a couple of years of COVID. And right now we're starting to see the hangover from what was an inebriated market that was just not working on fundamentals, working off of fairy tales.
Brianna,
I would love your opinion on this, because I have a theory about one of the main things that's causing inflation that I don't think is discussed enough, and that is the supply chain. So let me tell you about two of my hobbies. The first is collecting classic Porsches, right? Those prices have just skyrocketed through the roof, right? I have a 997. It was worth $40,000, you know, 3 years ago. Today, it's worth about $65,000 or $70,000. Pinball machines are another one, because people are spending so much time at home and it's so hard to buy these things new right now. My theory about why inflation is really leading to a lot of the fear in the stock market, I think a lot of it's the supply chain, just because it's so hard to get anything. Cameras, you know, even rare video game prices are just skyrocketing just across the board. I mean, I feel like we're not going to get a lot of these. I don't think we're going to get the market on the right track until we get like our supply line under track, because it's the two are very much connected.
Yeah. And so it doesn't look like the supply chain is going to get fixed anytime soon. Pat Gelsinger, CEO of Intel, was saying 2025. Not next year. That's the year after, just in case you don't know. Go ahead, Alex.
Well, the big debate is whether this inflation is supply chain related or whether it's interest rate related. I tend to agree with you, Brianna. I think that it is supply chain related. Here's a quick story. One of my parents' neighbors works in shipping. And to import a container from China, you know, he called me over. He's like, Alex, we're making money hand over fist, because it used to cost $2,000. Now we can make $15,000. And now it's cost, the cost is in the 20s, right? So the supply chain stopped. It started. There was huge demand. Ships didn't go back online. And then you ended up having this massive increase in containers, which ends up, you know, and shutdowns in China, right? Which causes supply contraction. And then, yeah, prices go up. And my neighbor goes, listen, there's going to be inflation. And lo and behold, you know, if you're working in shipping, you know. And he knew. And that's where we are now. But that being said, the Fed is still going to raise the rate, because the Fed, you know, understands that it's been an easy money environment for the last, you know, couple of years, that it tried to stoke the economy because of COVID. And so it feels responsible too. And so you might end up in a situation where you have the Fed raising the rate, which inevitably does compress the valuation of stocks, and that not so solving our inflation issue, which could lead us to all sorts of hell. And so I do think that when people say, you know, there's a chance we're going to end up in a recession in 2023, and the Fed says we'll have a soft landing, I tend to believe that the, you know, the people with the darker predictions on this one, because it's not going to be easy to fix. It was easy to keep our economy humming during a pandemic, which is, you know, somewhat of a miracle. But, you know, we have to pay the piper at a certain point, and this is where it's coming.
Might not have been that easy. We also spent a lot of money on COVID relief checks and loans. And some say that's also been a cause of
well, it's
inflation.
Like, yeah, exactly. It's like a credit card.
Yeah.
It's like a credit card. You know, easy to whip that out and spend tons of cash at the mall. But then the bill comes and you're like, God damn, where's the money for all this? And it's like, oh, we should have thought about that when we were doing it, because it felt like it was free when we were walking out of the mall. But eventually that bill does come due and there's interest on it.
Brianna, you told a story about inflation having to do with your, and the supply chain having to do with your hobbies. I have purchased many a Pokeball Plus in my life to play Pokemon Go. Lisa recently broke her Pokeball Plus, went online. It was $20 when I bought it before the pandemic, $144. But I can get it tomorrow. Now, Lisa's no fool, so she shopped around and she found somewhere where she could get it for $20, but you might not get it tomorrow. That was 3 months ago, and I think it's somewhere on a container ship between here and China. But, you know, if you want it tomorrow, you're going to pay a little bit more for your Pokeball Plus.
But you can tell Lisa I've got mine, and I don't play that game anymore, so if she needs that, I'll
Oh, you know, we might need an emergency Pokeball Plus loan. this allows you to walk around town without having your Pokemon Go game out all the time. You just press the button on the ball whenever it vibrates and you collect Pokemon.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Alex, I want to get back to one of the points you were making, though, about lower interest rates. And, you know, I do think that it's been artificially low for a really long time. And I think we don't talk about this enough, that, you know, when the interest rate is that low, it does have, you know, consequences through the rest of the industry, right? Like a low interest rate is not automatically a good thing. The other part of that is, I think my biggest criticism now that kind of the emergency has passed and we can look at what we actually got for all those for all the COVID relief that we spent. And I think it's really important to remember, we literally fired bazookas of cash at the Fed. There are plenty of people that made lots of money just following the stock market and seeing what the Fed was like basically propping up with all of that money. They made out like bandits there. And now that we're looking at how much of the money, the trillions that we spent on that, actually ended up in the hands of things like rent relief, right? Or things to actually help people, it's becoming more and more apparent that money was just frankly misallocated and we did need more oversight there. So, I just think it's important to realize when we have an emergency, it matters how you spend that money. And I think we're looking at it now and realizing it didn't really help people as much as it should have.
Well, not only totally. That, but to add insult to injury, the value of Bitcoin has plummeted, I say, over the last, is now down to $34,000, which I, if you don't pay a lot of money, a lot of attention to Bitcoin, I thought it was like well below 30, but apparently it had come back, goes up and goes down. I don't know. If you're all in on Bitcoin, it's a crazy ride. Isn't it?
Yeah, but you still did better in Bitcoin than you would have in like Shopify or Netflix.
That's
over the last
true.
Year.
What? How much did Shopify lose? 70% this year.
Shopify is down 70%.
70%. What is? Why are they hitting e-commerce sites?
They're in the crosshairs of all these trends, right? I mean, supply chain, right? That's definitely like Shopify, of course. So if you put Amazon can survive supply chain. Shopify is much more difficult for smaller merchants too.
Yeah.
And you put that and you combine that with inflation, right? People are going to try to, think about what they're going to sacrifice. I'm going to sacrifice buying from that Shopify site, most likely. I'm not going to buy that impulse purchase, from Facebook or Instagram anymore. And then, of course, they didn't have the growth, that they projected. And if you're, in an environment that rewards growth stocks, then you go to an environment that punishes growth stocks and you're not growing and you're dealing with supply chain and inflation. The stock's going to go down 70%, and that's what happened to Shopify.
I don't know if it's related to the fall in Bitcoin, and I don't know if I fully trust the Wall Street Journal on NFTs, but according to the Journal, NFT sales are flatlining. Actually, I've seen this in other places too. The daily average sale of non-fungible tokens down 92% from its peak of 225,000 in September, down to 19,000 tokens this week. The number of active wallets in the market, 88% down, 14,000 last week. What's going on? Is this just people, money's tight, not buying NFTs? Is this people saying, this whole NFT thing was a speculative bubble? That's my personal feeling, people wising up, or is it just a normal slowdown?
I think they ran out of bigger fools to market this to.
It's kind of my point of view. At some point, so a pyramid scheme, you get to the top of the pyramid, it's done.
100%. I don't know if you saw this, Leo. Did you see there's a fantastic YouTube channel called Legal Eagle?
Yes, and, I did see it. The Discord chat sent me a link to it. Hysterical.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. It's beautiful. So just in case your listeners have not seen this, it's a 40-minute video of basically the legal case around NFTs and asking yourself very critically, what are you actually buying? And I have to tell you, it is a spectacular takedown. I was actually more NFT before I saw this video, but then when he walks through all the legal arguments, I'm like, nope, this is a scam. And so his basic argument here is think of NFTs as basically a receipt showing that you bought something. The receipt does not work in lieu of the strongest protection you have to actually own something like a work of art. That's a copyright here. You can't say that it's subbed in one for the other. So as far as who actually owns the NFT itself, it's actually a very, very murky argument. He also goes into the way a lot of these are marketed and how there's a very, very good legal argument that they fall under the good old-fashioned lawsuits that you can find yourself faced with for fraud. fraud, pumping up schemes, promising something and getting something else. And even like if you're a creator creating these NFTs and hoping to make money from them, you could actually find yourself legally bound to follow through on some of these promises. An example he gives is like someone that buys an NFT having a right to basically talk to a creator about that. Well, there's a certain way to look at that agreement saying, well, if someone buys an NFT, you've got to get out of bed at 2 a.m. and go jump on a Zoom meeting with them, or you're out of line with the contract. So there's a lot of reason to be very legally careful with these. And I think that there's very little reason to feel like you actually own the work of art that you're actually buying with an NFT.
Wow. Yeah. Watch the video. It's really worth watching. Go ahead, Alex.
I was speaking to a Columbia Business School class and NFTs came up, and I was like a little bit probably too provocative, but I called it like business QAnon, which is unfair. But my thought on it was that it felt a lot like a collective delusion to me, that like people like looking at signs and stuff and believing in something that just wasn't there. And the next day I get a FaceTime from an investor friend of mine, Jason Stein. And he's like laughing, and he has like one of the students from Columbia Business School who was in that class sitting in his office talking about me. And I was like, all right, Jason.
Can you believe he's called it business QAnon?
Yeah, I know. Okay, that's fair. So Jason and I are going to have a debate about this on Big Technology Podcast this week.
Oh, good.
But I will say, we spoke a little bit about it. I do see some merit to it. But I think, why did NFTs explode the way they did? And it goes back again to zero interest rate policy, where you can't get a return by keeping your money on cash because the interest rate is zero. You look for alternate and riskier investments. And you know, okay, that could be riskier bonds, riskier stocks. And then all of a sudden it became kind of anything, Bitcoin, NFTs. And the thing is, when the interest rate is zero and everyone's looking for those investments. So it does seem like the price and the value is just going to keep going up because there's just more and more money flowing into the system. So why are NFTs, crashing at the same time the stock market is? It's because now the Fed is ripping that under and people are starting to see, I can get safer, more predictable returns. I don't need to be as risky, as I did before.
That makes too much sense. Yeah.
And so they leave business QAnon and they go into, treasury bond, cabals.
Yeah.
And that's where it goes.
I will say that I do not, as a matter of editorial policy, buy individual stocks of any kind, nor NFTs. I do own some Bitcoins because for a while we were allowing Bitcoin donations, but I can't access them because I forgot the password. So I don't have a dog in this hunt in any way. But I do have all of my retirement money, the money I hope to live on at some point, invested in the market, in index funds. And so, I am somewhat sensitive to this. And I realize that at least half of America does not own any stock, they're not in this at all. But it does impact the economy. It does affect inflation. It affects what the price you pay at the pump and at the grocery store. Maybe not directly, but it's certainly indirectly.
And it's crazy right now. I mean, you can be in cash and then down 8.5% because of inflation, or you could be in the S&P 500 and be down 13%.
Yeah.
It's like nowhere to go right now.
When the pandemic started, I thought I was real smart, and I converted all my holdings to cash, figuring the market would completely crash, and that turned out to be exactly the wrong thing to do. So I tucked my tail between my legs and got back into the S&P 500, into index funds, and it's been a great ride until a few months ago. Now I'm thinking maybe I should have stayed in cash. I don't know.
It's pretty scary right now.
It's scary if you're 65. It's scary.
Yeah.
If you, like most Americans, didn't save enough money for retirement, your Social Security is not going to provide for you. It is scary. And as somebody in that age group, I'm very sensitive to that.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
I think it's crazy is, when I bought like my pinball machines to keep me sane over the pandemic, it's like, I mean, those have all made money. I could go sell them today and I'll make 20% of what I paid for them.
You know? I wish I'd bought more of those Pokeballs, to be honest with
there
you. That's the
you
best. That would buy them at 20, sell them at 144. That's 700%.
100%. You know, I have a really dark, like, not dark, but this is my honest opinion about what's going on with NFTs. I think that, as you said, Leo, we have an entire generation that doesn't invest in the stock market. They've really been kind of locked out of economic prosperity in the way that, you know, my generation, and I think your generation has.
Mine is, I'm the boomers. Yeah. And, right. And, you know, we are the ones who, I'm sorry, that's all I can say. We put right. you, and my kids who are millennials and the Gen Zers, they are dead-end jobs. They're working their butts off. They have, you know, horrific, and they can't afford a home. They are really screwed.
Right. It stinks to be a millennial. You come out, you got
terrible.
A recession, then you move into, the economy recovers, get another recession, and then you're just like, you know, hitting your stride of your career and COVID happens.
So, horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. But to come back to my point with this, I 100% agree with that. I think that you have a generation there and they're looking at, well, how do I get on my feet, right? How do I get a footing? And I think Bitcoin and NFTs have been, I think it really appeals to people.
Well, it's magical thinking, but they're at the point where they need
right.
it. They need magical
thinking. Right, 100%. And they're thinking like, okay, NFTs and Bitcoin are technically complicated. They just are. And you think to yourself, okay, I'm smart enough to understand this concept. Therefore, it's worth investing my money in. There's definitely this meme culture behind it that Elon's been very successful in, you know, tagging himself onto. And I think it's really led to these investments that are detached from, you know, things I certainly learned when I took business classes, you know, PDE ratio or just basic fundamentals of a stock. And I think it's another scam on an entire generation, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I
understand that. And I've been having this kind of discussion with myself and with others for about a year. As stock prices get more and more divorced from fundamentals, they become more and more indistinguishable from cryptocurrencies. They're pure speculative investments. And at that point, well, why not invest in Bitcoin? It's just as speculative. There's no, if Elon Musk's Tesla is worth hundreds of, you know, 100 times more than the entire auto industry put together, then it's speculative. So might as well buy Bitcoin. I completely understand that. Go ahead, Alex.
I mean, I'll just say that I wish when I was younger, there was a GameStop situation or an AMC. And I think the optimistic...
But don't you think many people are going to get hurt too by that? There's,
yeah.
For every upside, there's a downside.
Totally. But it's much better to get hurt in your 20s because then you start to learn about how to not get hurt. And I do think that this moment really brought a lot of retail investors online, and they're going to make mistakes in their 20s that, you know, they otherwise
maybe
might have made
learn.
In their 30s or
yes.
40s
yeah.
and learn, hey, wait, you know what?
No, that's a good point.
I mean, like once
yeah.
people, when you put money into something, you all of a sudden have an incentive to learn a lot more about it. And maybe people will start to like, you know, they're probably, you have young people reading CNBC. You know, people, I didn't read it when I was in my 20s. You have young people reading the website, watching the channel. And they're going to learn, you know, eventually you speak to enough people and you realize, you know, the way to make money in the markets is to put it in indices like you're doing, Leo, and then wait for a while.
Yeah, but
and
I didn't learn that. You're right. I didn't learn that to my 40s
exactly.
and 50s. You're
Wouldn't
right.
it have been awesome if you had a GameStop when you were in your 20s where you could learn that hard lesson early and then make the right moves? Because, you know, that does compound over time. So I take optimistic lens over this, and I say it's probably a good thing. And hopefully, you know, this crypto thing will sort itself out. But overall, I think this is largely positive.
I agree and disagree with that. I agree that it's good that some of these people are learning a hard lesson. Like there were stories about, you know, people and what they did during the GameStop explosion, like people that went and took $80,000 of debt out at like 15% interest rates, right? Like just crazy stuff. At the same time, you know, if we're talking economics here, there's an externality to all of this. And the externality is you can look at poll numbers and you can see, you can ask this generation, like, do you believe in like the fundamentals of like the stock market working and, you know, like the basic promise of America? Like, do you believe in things that, frankly, I'm a Gen Xer. I'm the last year of Gen X. We believed in this.
Yes.
And I think that this generation is coming away remarkably cynical with this. And I think they do have a correct impression that the stock market is rigged for certain people. Like, you look at payment for order flow, and just the ways that you fail to you basically break the market for people with more information. I think they've come to a correct conclusion. So yes, I agree with you that they could learn a lesson here, but I think that
the lesson may be pretty dystopian.
Right. It's
by
dystopian.
The way, yeah. But look, I think that first of all, it's more than just the market that is informing these opinions. And second of all, if you're in your 20s and you understand a concept like payment for order flow, you are way ahead of the game. Because
and
in
many
order to
people
beat the
learned
market,
that lesson from Robinhood.
Yes. Look, yes, you're going to just to bring this point home. The market is rigged. And if you understand that, that's when you can start to make decisions that are going to be good for your long term financial health. If you are not going to understand that and you're going to stay out, you're going to be in cash. And you'd be down 8.5% because of inflation. So are there going to be horror stories that we can point to? Without a doubt, there are in every situation. That being said, is there going to be a large benefit because there's going to be financial literacy among young people that there wasn't, let's say, in my generation? Absolutely, 100%. I view that as a good thing.
Here's the thing, Alex, and I think this is what Brianna is saying as well. Yeah, all well and good. They're getting an education. If there's an alternative that makes sense. And right now, all you're learning is you're out of luck. There is no like, well, okay, good. And now I understand that the market is rigged. So I'm going to do what? What is this? What is the alternative? Right.
I mean, it's obvious. Where is it rigged? It's rigged in places like Robinhood, where there is payment for order flow, where your free trade isn't trade. And all young kids know that right now. So what do? You're going to go to a different service where that doesn't make money off of payment for order flow and probably invest in index funds and sit there and wait for a long time.
God, I hope so.
And that's how you're going to make money.
I hope so.
I mean,
that's why I'm always telling my kids, you know,
absolutely.
Yeah. Buy the index funds.
Yeah. There are a canon of books that get passed along once you speak enough about this stuff, you know, I think really highly of the younger generations right now. And I do believe, and speaking with, you know, people in that generation, I do believe they get it. I do believe there's a hunger to get it. And I think they're going to be way better off. Are there going to be mistakes? Yes. But can you find places to get good returns on your money? 100%. That is true. They could probably, you know, being young right now, buy the S&P 500 discounted, you know, given that it's going through the hard time that it is at the moment. So I don't think it's all negative on this front.
If you're under a certain age, how old are you, Alex?
35.
Oh, see, you're still a baby. Brianna, from my point of view, you're still a baby. This is when I woke up. I wish it had been sooner. By the way, Aunt, you're zoomed in. Can you unzoom in on my screen? The guy, he's passed away at the age of 67. It's very sad. He was the guy who ran the institutional portfolio for Yale, and there you go, did very well, surprisingly well, wrote a book called Unconventional Success that I highly recommend to anybody who is under Alex's age, who has learned this lesson, but then now doesn't know, well, okay, so what should I get? I guess I lost my shirt on Dogecoin. What should I get? And that's is exactly the strategy you and I have been talking about, but it's a little bit more detailed. Highly recommend it. Unconventional Success by David Swensen, Swensen.
You could do what I do and just put all your money into Porsches.
Or buy Porsches and pinball machines, baby.
Yeah, wait for those to go up.
That's a great strategy. You did say something, though, Brianna, that I think is problematic, and not just in the markets, but in general. The United States, as I think any time people, humans, achieve something as a group, it's because they have a shared mythology. Mm-hmm. And in the U.S., we had and I say it past tense, I'm sad to say, we had a shared mythology of you can make it with hard work and intelligence, that democracy is good, speech is good, that we all are in this together, that we need to compromise to get forward. There were all these mythologies we had about the United States and probably the most important, the rule of law. And those, I feel those mythologies have been shattered. And I think that once that happens in a country, and I've seen it happen in other countries, the center cannot hold. Things fall apart. You will not survive as a nation. And it is now I say mythologies because they're kind of made up. I understand. But the belief in them, the fundamental belief in the perfectibility of humans and a country that can go forward and take care of all of its people and all of that, we've never really done that right, but we believed in it and we tried to do that, is what keeps a country together. And I feel like that is where we really are going to have a problem. And it's not just the markets. The markets are just a bellwether of what's going to happen ultimately, where we've kind of lost our sense of what the American dream is all about.
I don't know if you saw the Atlantic article a couple of weeks ago. Yes. This really struck me as the most true thing I've ever read.
Jonathan
about
Haidt, right? Yeah.
I think so. It was the one that basically talked about what is going on right now.
Why
being
the
like
past
the Tower of Babel.
10 years of American life have been uniquely stupid.
Right. It was talking about how it's like the Tower of Babel myth in the Bible. And if you didn't read that growing up, basically what happens, this myth that basically everyone left speaking different languages, and it's how we kind of fragmented as a species and went all around the globe. And I think that's really true. I mean, look at the discussion we just had on Elon Musk and what a different, you know, concept free speech means to me as someone that's really dealt with the brunt of trolls in a very dramatic way, and to someone like Elon Musk. We have such separate assumptions there. I think when society doesn't have a story that they can all like make sense of the world with, I think it's really dangerous. And I think, you know, for me, when I was coming of age, I remember the Gulf War, the first Gulf War with George Bush Sr., right? And I think that that incident really shaped a lot of the way that like my generation saw these American institutions, because we saw all these things working basically. And I think if you come to what's happened in all the years since, it just seems to get worse and worse and worse. And all of us have our own different stories about why we've gotten that way. And I don't know how much longer American society can last if we don't have some sort of shared story about who we are
exactly.
And where we want to go.
And I don't mean to say that if you were black, 50 years ago, life was good. I don't mean this kind of foggy nostalgia for the good old days. I mean, and I think you would mean as well. I know you mean as well,
yeah.
Brianna. That dream of what it could be that was first set out in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And, of course, we've never lived up to. But we still have to dream and work and strive for that. And once people disagree and say, no, you know, that's not it, then we work in different directions and the whole thing falls apart. And
there was a story that
worries me considerably. Yeah. It really does.
There was a story that George Bush Sr. liked to tell about the first Iraq war. And basically a bunch of American soldiers captured a bunch of Iraqis, and they were really, really worried that they were going to be killed and tortured. And the American soldiers laughed and said, look, we're Americans. We don't torture people. Of course not. And not to say that it's not true that we haven't created atrocities as a nation, but I remember hearing that at 12 and saying, that's my ideal
right.
about who I want to be as a country,
right.
right? That we would laugh at the thought, which is why things like Abu Ghraib hurt so much, because it was so contrary to my personal ideals.
That's exactly right.
I think if you ask a lot of people in this generation, like, is this the story of America? Is this the direction we want to go? I think you get a much more cynical answer. And yeah, I think we can have an adult conversation about how we've missed the mark, and God knows we have, but we need stories about who we want to be and where we want to go.
Yeah, it's really about who we want to be, not who we were ever.
Yeah.
But how we want to be. And of course, yeah, as soon as we decided that waterboarding's not torture, we did torture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would just say we're suffering from a decline in institutions across the board. And important ones, religion, for instance. You know, the fastest growing religion in the U.S. is none, right? People are not identifying with religion. Community organizations are in decline, especially after COVID. Our government is not actually exactly acting, you know, like adults in many cases. And then work, you know, we get a lot of meaning from work, and, you know, a lot of jobs out there have gone away or, you know, are just like, yeah, not terrible. They're not good to be in, like, you know, for instance, in an Amazon fulfillment center. And when all that stuff starts falling away and you don't have a link to your community, then you add in two years of being, you know, forced to sit at home. It does devastating things to society.
Yeah, I think that's true. We said during the pandemic, this is bringing to a head. Problems have been simmering under mm-hmm. the surface for some time, and now they're here.
Yes.
Yeah, like income inequality and like a breakdown of institutions.
And then you add on top of that the fact that the health institution didn't exactly conduct itself in a great way. They were way too sure. They said, we know this to be true. We know this not to be true. And they didn't know. And, you know, they lost credibility. And, you know, of course, then once it was very easy to politicize the health establishment because they lost trust, you know, among the people.
Right.
And especially if you come out of a pandemic, you can't trust in the institution of like your centralized health systems. What can you trust in? And the answer for many people became nothing.
Let's not forget, this was the week that we crossed 1 million deaths due to COVID-19 in the United States.
Some people.
Yeah, that's a lot of people. Alex Kantorowicz is here. Big Technology. He does the Big Technology podcast, bigtechnology.substack.com, for his newsletter. The author of Always Day One about big tech. Of course, Brianna Wu, game developer, executive director at the Rebellion Pack, and Porsche and pinball collector.
That's it.
Our show today brought to you by Worldwide Technology, WWT, and Cisco. WWT is working with clients all over the world to transform their businesses. At the heart of WWT, the Advanced Technology Center, the ATC, an amazing, amazing research and testing lab that brings together technologies from all the leading OEMs. More than $500 million in equipment invested in the lab. Lisa and I visited it a couple of years ago and were blown away. I can't wait to go back. But what's great about the ATC, I mean, of course, it was designed initially for the engineers and partners at WWT to use it to spin up proofs of concept and pilots to understand technologies, how they interact, to confidently select the best solutions. But now, huge, WWT has made it available to all of the members of its platform, you, for free. Hundreds of on-demand and schedulable labs representing the newest advances in multi-cloud architecture and security, networking, primary and secondary storage, data analytics, AI, DevOps. You can test out products and solutions at the ATC before you go to market. Not just labs, technical articles, expert insights, demonstration videos, white papers, all the tools you need to stay up to date with the latest technology. Most recently, WWT's engineers and partners have been using the ATC to help customers confidently select the best solutions for enabling hybrid work, something we're all facing now. On WWT.com, you'll find valuable resources related to hybrid work technologies, office hoteling, practical advice for reopening offices, strategies for improving your digital workspace. We all need this. We are in a terra incognita, unknown lands right now, but WWT's been there and they can help. And when you're ready to dive deeper, you can launch on-demand learning labs to gain hands-on experience with specific technologies and develop your skill set in a risk-free environment. If you've got questions, WWT has all kinds of events where you'll hear directly from experts as they discuss solutions to common hybrid work challenges. If you want to learn more, there's all sorts of additional resources and demo videos and just it's amazing. There's so much to explore, and it's all at WWT.com. Create an account today. Follow hybrid work to stay up to date on the latest technologies, events, research, content, and more. Whatever your business need, WWT, Worldwide Tech, can deliver scalable, tried and tested, tailored solutions. Worldwide Technology brings strategy and execution together to make a new world happen. And man, we are in a new world. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, to gain access to all those free resources, WWT.com/twit. Create a free account on the ATC platform. It's all there for you. WWT.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting This Week in Tech. We're getting very philosophical, very heady here. It's great. I love it. We have smart people on. It's great to talk about things that sometimes I think don't get talked about, you know? And they're so important to understanding what's going on. Otherwise, it's just chaos.
So it's all about the metaverse. We're really just living in the metaverse, Leo.
I hope so. I can't wait.
That's how it goes.
As I've pointed out before, if you read about the metaverse in science fiction, invariably, I don't care if it's Neal Stephenson or William Gibson, it's to escape a dystopia, Ernie Klein. It's always to escape a horrific hellscape of real life.
Give me them goggles.
Let me slap them on.
Right now.
I was talking
about. Yeah, there was a story that came out last week. It was about the Pope not wanting to go on the record about a big, long, a huge project they were doing in the metaverse. I was like, did you not read Snow Crash? This is literally the plot with Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates. I'm like, who's L. Bob Reif in this? Is it Zuckerberg? Is it Elon?
I hate to say it, Father Robert Ballasaire definitely involved. At least he's one of ours, right?
I would trust him.
He talks about being working. He says, I can't talk about what we're working on right now. He's the digital Jesuit. He was called back. For those who don't know, he was a regular. He was one of our hosts. Called back to the Vatican some years ago. He was the guy who got the Pope on Skype. he's a Jesuit, so as is the Pope. And the Jesuits trust him, and I think he's their ambassador to the world of technology. I have to think Robert's fairly involved. And by the way, I should mention, this Thursday, Robert's going to do a fireside chat on our Club Twit. So we're going to ask him. Ant, you're going to ask him. Say, Robert, are you working on the metaverse for Father, the Holy Father? Father Robert Ballasaire will be here at 9 a.m. If you're a member of Club Twit, you can watch, participate live, ask those questions, 9 a.m. Pacific, May 12th. Just one of many things that go on inside Club Twit. If you're not yet a member, can I encourage you to join? It really helps us cover the bills, frankly. $7 a month, not much to ask. You do get a lot of benefits, ad-free versions of all the shows, because you're giving us money. We don't need to have advertisers, so that's nice. Access to the Discord, which is always great. And there's lots of stuff going on in there. Events, shows we don't put out on the feeds, like the Untitled Linux Show, the Giz Fizz, Stacy's Book Club. They're going to be doing Neal Stephenson's latest Termination Shock.
That's so good.
I can't wait to read it. I'm trying to read it before it's big. It's thick. It's a heavy book.
It's good, though. It's worth your time.
I love Neal. That's going to be the conversation on June 16th in about a month. You have a little time to read that. So much stuff going on, plus the Twit Plus feed, where stuff we talk about not in shows appears, plus those other shows. And every in the Discord, the Discord is incredible. Conversations about not just all the shows, but autos, coding, comics, ham radio and hardware and movies and music, sci-fi, software, even sports and sport ball. Woohoo!
That's the Club Twit Discord?
Yeah.
Nice. So it's moving well. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was here when you launched it, and it looks like it's really robust.
We're very happy.
Robust.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I think it's become a great place to hang out. We're very happy with it. I realize Discord is a social network
that
is really fantastic, actually. So $7 a month, twit.tv/clubtwit. Yeah, I think since, because, you know, we follow closely what you do, Alex, and others to kind of, you know, create a membership. And, you know, we're trying to look at all the best practices and stuff. And when we started, what was that, a year ago now? Something like that. When is that the anniversary? Right, yeah. Pretty soon, I think. We now have, I don't know, is it 4,000, 5,000 members? The Discord itself is only about 3,000 people. Not everybody wants to join the Discord. But we're very, it's helped us a lot.
4,000 members. Congratulations.
Yeah. It's thank you. And thanks to our members. We really appreciate it. All right, let's talk. So before the show, I was talking about privacy and how I've changed my tune. For a long time, I worried that being absolutist about privacy was going to hurt the kinds of technologies, slow down the development of technologies that would be fabulously useful. Things like Google Assistant. You know, Siri is Apple's privacy-forward version of that, just not as good because it's privacy-forward. And for a long time, I thought, well, privacy, yeah, everybody, I mean, I understand the desire for privacy, but really all of these tracking technologies are doing is, you know, targeting ads. What's the harm in that, right? Everybody makes a big deal about it. But you know, and people like Dvorak would say, well, just wait till the insurance companies get a hold of it and they deny you insurance because they know you went to Dunkin' Donuts four times last week. Yeah, when that happens, you know, maybe there's a cause for concern. Well, it started to happen. So now I am a little more careful and a little less sanguine about privacy concerns. Here's the one that stopped me in my tracks. There's a data broker called Safegraph. Not a good name. Well, not an appropriate name. They were selling for $160 because Motherboards Vice bought it, the data of everybody who visited a Planned Parenthood over a period of time. $160, no warrant, anybody could buy it. And now you immediately see the risk, especially in light of what may be the overturning of Roe v. Wade. That could be information that could put you in jail.
Yeah.
In Texas, for sure, and get you sued. Safegraph says, oh, whoops, we didn't mean to do that, and we're going to change it. Yeah, okay, fine. But these data brokers, you could see, you could start to see as stories come out about law enforcement and others using these data brokers about people being doxxed. You know, there's a big story about how Apple, Google, Snap, and others had inadvertently given information to people posing as law enforcement. They didn't check because it was an emergency request. And they said, oh, yeah, it's an emergency. Here's Brianna Wu's home address. We're starting to see the problem here. Your OPSEC is probably very good by now, Brianna, I'm sure.
It is. But I want to tell you, Leo, with my current job, we do a lot of ad targeting. We do work with a lot of these data brokers. And I hesitate to use the word dystopian, but it is very concerning just how much information they have and what they can do with it. Let me give you a specific example. If I'm working in an election and I want to target people that have, let's say an issue of like, I don't know, $15 minimum wage or let's say bankruptcy, right? I can actually go out there and request everyone that's read an article on, say, how to file for bankruptcy in their Google results. And then that will be tied to their unique ID identifier. And I can serve them ads on that across multiple networks. I mean, it is a truly staggering amount of information there. I've been saying for a long time, this needs to be regulated. And just one more point here. I didn't know this until I started running for Congress and I started talking to various people that were basically defendants, lawyers that worked defense cases. There is such an asymmetric power of discovery in if the government wants to pursue a case against you in the information they are able to subpoena and find. We're talking Nest cams, where your Google account has been. Basically, they can just keep collating all this data until they find something that is basically builds the case that they want. Oftentimes, it's using data that is incomplete or, you know, may give them an incorrect picture of the situation.
But might be very compelling to a jury because it's technology. Exactly. And, well, we know how good that is.
A really good example. There was a guy that had someone else's phone with him in his bag, and he ended up being put on the location of a murder scene in New York, right? That was very compelling evidence. And, you know, you don't have that same power of discovery to prove that you aren't there. So this is a very important issue, and I'm glad people are finally seeing this.
I'm sure this is, you're finally, Alex saying, well, finally, Leo, you finally came around. Took you long enough.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting because I am sympathetic with your view. Like I do think, or your previous view, I do think that like a lot of times data can actually be useful for us, especially when it comes to targeted advertising. Like I would rather have better ads than worse ads. And I think that like many things on the internet, the discussion of privacy has become flattened and polarized, whereas it's an extremely nuanced conversation where we should say, you know, I don't think you can say it's good or evil. I can say there are useful and destructive purposes. And do we have the attention span to talk about some of the, you know, useful and destructive purposes and actually push us towards a better internet versus having to be all in or all out, you know, on one way or the other. And I feel like we've always had good discussions about it here, you know, on Twit. And I think that this is yet another data point where we look and, you know, we found more stuff that we need to be skeptical about. But, you know, I'm going to go back to a point I made earlier, which is that we're in the like first inning of the internet. I mean, so early on, and this is like our opportunity to determine what the direction we're going in is going to be. And, you know, I think that like, if we can find the wherewithal to concentrate on these cases, we're actually going to be in a much better place than if we go all the way on one side and say privacy is good, you know, or all the way on the other side and say, you know, it's bad. Like there's nuance here. But these cases that you're bringing up, I mean, are extremely, you know, concerning and alarming, and stuff that we do need to get start to get dealing with.
Here's one I have mixed feelings about. Also from Motherboard Advice, the CDC tracked millions of phones to see if Americans followed COVID lockdown orders. New documents from the CDC show that they bought access to location data, again, from these brokers harvested from tens of millions of phones. I mean, in this case, I think there's a real benefit, a public health benefit. They were now, you know, they were analyzing in aggregate. You know, they didn't care about what you or I did. They wanted the mass of people. They tracked patterns of people visiting K-12 schools. They specifically monitored the effectiveness of policy in the Navajo Nation. Good or bad?
I think I read that and I'm like, okay, I can see where they're doing is a study about this to understand the effect of the policy that they are bringing out. And then you can see how it's going to be weaponized and turned into another stupid left versus right screaming match, which is very concerning, obviously. To come back to your point though, Alex, I don't think that we need more conversations about this. What I think we need is smarter regulators who are actually interested in thinking about these policies and coming to better decisions on this. It doesn't ultimately matter what you and I say. If it's legal, there's going to be a market for it, and they're going to care about making money more than doing the right thing, as I think our current situation shows. So I think I just feel like there's no path forward I have confidence in where Congress is going to get really interested in regulating ad tech to make sure it's not abused in these situations, unfortunately. So that's how I feel.
I think that like, it's not exactly what I said. I think the regulation is always downstream of like the conversations that experts have. And I hope that when we have, you know, if regulators are interested in this, and I know they are, right, then they should also have nuanced conversations about it. But all I'm trying to say is painting with a broad brush isn't going to do anyone any good because, there's plenty of details here that need to be addressed. And, you know, if we're going to go in and say like, it's exactly the problem to go in and say like, you know, they need to be regulated. They don't need to be regulated. It sort of gets us back to a place where we're not making smart policy. So I'll stand here on the table and scream for nuanced conversations, you know, sure, places like this and in the public forum. And then when it gets there in Congress and in the halls of government regulators as well.
An interesting side note on this, by the way, Vice got this information from a Freedom of Information Act. CDC paid a data broker, guess who? Safegraph. $420,000 for access to a year of data. Safegraph's investors include Peter Thiel, the former head of Saudi intelligence. Google was so concerned about Safegraph, they banned the company's apps from the Play Store in June.
Unsafegraph.
Unsafe. Unsafegraph. But, again, I mean, I think the National Health Agency, the CDC, probably has a real interest, a public interest in finding out some general patterns on how people are behaving in pandemic. Although if you look at the list of potential use cases that the CDC listed, there's quite a few of them. Quite a few of them. And some of them you might feel a little funny about. I think we do need to talk about this. Unfortunately, I don't really trust Congress to do anything sensible about any of this. So you use data brokers, which is interesting to me, Brianna. So you clearly, you have a use case that you feel is good and justified.
So here, I just got done working an election last week, right? We our candidate was very strongly advocating a $15 minimum wage, right? We targeted that ad at people that made under $60,000 a year, right? And were part of the party that we were representing and were registered voters, right? Those are some subgroups. And I think I would argue that an ethical use of all this data is, look, if there's a politician that's going to represent a policy that you believe in, I don't think it's really problematic for me to find that out and then show you information that will get you out to vote, right? What I am saying, and this coming back to your nuanced conversation, Alex, is that when you really dig down deep in how they get those ad identifiers and how they figure out who is interested in what, it's in some really creepy ways. And I think there's, I think we don't really have consent about all the ways we are being tracked around the internet. Just one last thing. I am pretty paranoid, I would say, in the amount of information I give up as I go around the internet. And I've looked at my own file there, and it's frightening, the amount of information that's there, particularly with news sites and articles that I read that they end up having information about. So
it's very tempting just to give up, isn't it? It's
like, yeah, it really is, to be honest.
What are you going to do? So
and the CDC shouldn't be asking for any data because those people couldn't tie their shoes right during the pandemic.
There's other types of recommendations they're giving.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
Focus on the health stuff first, then go get the data.
Little public service announcement. So there has been for a long time, most of the browsers, except notably Google Chrome, have had a setting called Do Not Track. Google says we don't do it because it doesn't do anything. And in fact, they're right. Do Not Track is a suggestion. And most, in fact, as far as I know, all sites ignore Do Not Track. Well, thanks to GDPR and the California Consumer Privacy Act, CCPA, there is a new sheriff in town, which has some, this time, some real teeth. Global privacy control is part of GDPR. You may or may not know, but under GDPR, the fines can be as much as 10% of global revenue. They can be a serious, much more serious punishment. That was a problem with Do Not Track. There was no consequence. CCPA and GDPR are giving us a new tool. And right now, this is available in Firefox 100, which just came out. You can see I'm at a website called globalprivacycontrol.org, and you can see at the very top, I've got a little red light saying the GPC signal is not detected. Please download a browser extension that supports it. There are extensions. Steve Gibson talked about this on Wednesday on Security Now. There are extensions you can add. I don't know if you can add it to Chrome, to Safari, I believe, and Edge, that will turn it on. But if you are lucky enough to be using Firefox, there's a good reason to use Firefox. You can type about:config in Firefox, and that it'll warn you, yo, this is risky. You're going to do advanced configuration. Are you sure you know how to? And then there's a search box at the top. Let me Okay, I'm in full screen and you can barely see this, but I'm going to type global privacy, one word, and I'll see before I finish two settings, privacy, global privacy control enabled, and privacy, global privacy control functionality enabled. They are both false by default, but if you click that double headed arrow, you can turn them to true. And now you've made Firefox, any site you visit, say, I want global privacy. Now if I go to the globalprivacycontrol.org, it can see the signal. And you can go further if you want. You can test it against the reference server and see, you know, what's going on. There is, I at least have some hope that this will be honored by websites. It is never going to be available in Chrome. It's pretty clear Google has no interest in global privacy of any kind. But at least in Firefox, you can do this. And I think it's worth turning that on. So a little public service announcement there.
You know, it's so hard because Chrome is such a great product. But just for exactly the reason you just said, Leo, I have no faith in any of the ad tracking stuff on there. And sadly, I'm willing to sacrifice RAM and speed for privacy on my machine.
I'm just going to say, try Firefox. It's great. And the other reason I use Firefox is we're rapidly getting into a monoculture where we only have Chrome and Chrome derivatives. Edge is Chrome. Brave is Chrome. Vivaldi is Chrome. A lot of these browsers, they're de-Googled. Chromium is Chrome. But they're still the Chrome engine. And regardless of how you feel about privacy, I don't think it's a healthy ecosystem for all the web to be dominated by one browser engine. It makes it easier for developers, I guess. But I want to keep Firefox's usage numbers are tumbling now. Mm. I want to keep it alive. So I use it on all my machines. And you know what? It's a great browser. Highly recommending. It also containerizes Facebook. That's right.
Doug, ooh.
Yeah. And that's another good reason to use it. When I see any, whenever you go to a site with a Facebook like button, you're sending a signal back to Facebook unless using Firefox, and you can turn that on, and it will block that. I have come completely around on this. I feel like, all right, especially government agencies have now shown a willingness to impinge on our privacy for their own gains. And it's too bad.
You got a new guy here.
I know. Cool. I'm with you, Alex. I don't want to be privacy absolutist. Yeah. It is nuanced.
That's the thing. Yeah. And I think that from what I understand, having spoken with you about this over the years, your standpoint has basically been it's almost as if the conversation went too far to one end and you're a little sanity here.
Yeah.
And now we're starting to see, okay, actually now people are abusing and you're a little sanity here. So I think your position has actually been consistent. It's about, trying to rein in some of the polls on both sides, which I find valiant.
Valiant and quixotic. Foolish.
I'm just trying to understand the period of tech history where we went overboard on privacy implementation and made users so safe that it made the product worse. And I just
I'm not
can't
saying
think
implementation.
Of when that would have been.
Yeah. I'm not saying implementation. I'm just saying that there was a moment where the conversation, became scaremongering and sort of lost credibility because it was being held by people who didn't have a full understanding of the technology and was proposing solutions that just were, weren't going to be effective. And that's what I'm saying. I would want those conversations to be drawn back to a place where we actually can have solutions we can implement that will work, versus people giving TED Talks and selling books, based off of, ideas that sound really nice and when addressed in public, but are, can be extreme and difficult to actually put into practice.
And I'm just enough of a utopianist, to think that there are some really amazing things, that can be done with the information, the data stream that comes off of me, that would be very useful to me. And so in a way, what I really want to advocate it for is tight controls on what can be done with that data so that I want to be able to give Google my data and not have it automatically be sent to somebody like SafeGraph for use against me in a court of law. But I want it to be used by Google to give me valuable insights into, or just to simply pop up my plane ticket when I arrive at the airport. Those are useful things. You may say those are such toys that I should probably give those up in favor of better privacy, and maybe I'm going to have to. But I think if you control it, if we control what they can do with it, then there are some real benefits to be gained by giving them that information. We just have to get to a point where we can trust them with it. Even Apple, I'm not sure I can completely trust Apple with that information. Maybe that for some people, that's the solution. Just use an iPhone.
No, I think that's silly. Mm-hmm. If you think Apple's going to protect you from everything, I think another under-discussed thing we're not talking about is as cars really become more always-on internet appliances. There's a real risk of this information. Like, let's say you drove to an abortion clinic, right?
Could they
subpoena that if your car has GPS
knows.
In it?
Tesla yep. knows. Records everywhere you go.
One of my newer cars, it has GPS built into it. It's used as like a subscription thing you can use to find out, is someone speeding while they're driving it or where it's parked if it was stolen, right? But the downside to that is like, do I really believe that Porsche, who hasn't updated their iPhone app since like the last 10 years, do I really believe they've got a top-notch InfoSec team stopping those servers from being hacked? Do I really, really believe Porsche is going to put up a real fight if the United States government starts subpoenaing them to find out where their users have been driving to? I have no faith in any of that. And I think that's why we need smart regulation.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. And maybe there is a technological solution. Somebody in the chat room is reminding us about Tim Berners-Lee, the Solid Foundation. This was a goal, and it's still around as far as I know. The creator of the World Wide Web wanted to create a system where you would kind of silo your personal information and control what happens to it and offer it, intentionally to people who could use it appropriately, but maintain control of it. And I think it's a very good idea. We'll see if it happens. But I think there might be technological solutions. I might have higher hopes for that than regulatory solutions.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, although I am turning on that global privacy control for sure. Mm-hmm. I definitely want that on.
It's weird because like the best solutions are often like, let people control and then let them make money on their data. But those are just kind of, it's possible that that's where we end up getting to, but those can be tough to actually give people a strong enough return that they're going to be able to want to put the time in to do it.
Yeah. Take a little tiny break. More to come in just a bit with our great panel, Alex Kantrowitz, host of the Big Technology Podcast. I'm going to definitely listen next week. Or I guess
it's going to be fun.
I can't wait. Yeah.
We're going to get into it.
Yeah. You're brave.
NFTs.
Do you have a format for debate or is it just, you back and forth? Or how are you going to do that?
The format is no holds barred.
Oh, it's God. Go time. It's the cage match.
We'll take a break
goes.
At some point. That's right. But it's going to definitely be full-on podcast combat. It'll be fun.
Oh, I can't wait. Just search for Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Yes?
That's right.
Okay. Brianna Wu, who also does her share of podcasts, including The Fabulous Rocket with Christina and Simone de Rochefort and Christina Warren. Congratulate Christina. I'm sure you have. Are being featured by NPR.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I'm worried it's going to fuel her bad spending habits already. If you know Christina, she will waste money on anything. She was featured in NPR for her penchant to buy up dead tech company merch, like Theranos stuff. And
here she is wearing a MoviePass t-shirt in the NPR article. She has an awesome Christina. CNN Plus pop socket. She said the Holy Grail was her Theranos, any Theranos merchandise. And I've seen some Theranos merchandise like pens, very expensive. So you're right.
We're working on that. I told her I'd go halfies with her. If she wanted some pens, then she can have three of them. And I'd take two.
Here she is with her Fyre Festival t-shirt. God.
This is what I love about Rocket. We're a serious show that we cover the really big stories, but the other half of it is just ridiculous stuff like Firefest and Theranos. And we're a really good mix of silly and serious.
Relay.fm/Rocket. And it is definitely two great shows, Big Technology Podcast and Rocket. from our two great contributors. Our show today brought to you by Mint Mobile. Oh, I love my Mint Mobile, man. I spend, as you might imagine, a lot of money on cell phone service. You know, as an occupational hazard, I have Verizon, Sprint and T-Mobile are kind of merging. That's been an interesting experience, by the way. I'll tell you that story. And AT&T. I have all the big three because I'm keeping an eye on all three. But I'll tell you what, when it's my money to spend, I got Mint Mobile. If it's your money you're spending, you'll want Mint Mobile, the best wireless carrier. $15 a month gives you an incredible deal, unlimited nationwide talk and text, and plenty of data. You can buy more if you need it, but 4 gigs of data a month, I think, for $15 is a that's all in, $15. Now they have a new family plan, and this is awesome. They call it the Modern Family Plan. You'll only need 2 lines to get started. Mint Mobile is amazing. They basically got rid of the stores and saved enough money that they were able to give you wireless, just $15 a month. And now with the family plan, you're getting even more. All plans would come with unlimited talk and text, high-speed data on the nation's largest 5G network. The family plan lets you mix and match data plans. So it's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. You can get it just right for whoever you are in the family. Papa Bear, Mama Bear, a baby bear. Everybody gets the right amount of data for them. You can use your own phone. Bring your own phone. They will send you a SIM for free. They'll port your number over so your number doesn't change. Or you can buy a phone from them. In fact, I've got an iPhone SE. I love my iPhone SE from Mint Mobile. To get your new wireless plan, take a look at the family plan if you've got two or more lines. Or just for yourself, $15 a month, including the Modern Family Plan, mintmobile.com/twit. It's minty fresh. They'll even send you the plan, the SIM card, and everything for free. mintmobile.com/twit. It's time to shake up the wireless industry. And I'll tell you what, when it comes to spending my own money, that's where I go. mintmobile.com/twit. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month. It's like a quarter of what I spent with these other guys. It's amazing. For the same service. Let's see here. Moving right along down the rundown. Google I.O. is coming up this week. Google's developer conference. We're going to do a live coverage of the keynote, 10 a.m. on Wednesday. Jeff Jarvis will join me and Jason Howell as we cover the keynote. We don't know how long it'll be. This is sort of a semi-return to normal. They're going to have an audience, but it will be mostly Google employees and I think some lucky journalists. We don't know what they're going to announce, but there seems to be some consensus they will announce some things, including a Pixel Watch. Google has never made a watch.
Ooh.
They've offered Android Wear for some time. Other companies have made it, like Motorola and Fossil. This is in the middle, comparing it to the Galaxy 4 Classic and the iPhone on the left. In the middle is the Google Watch minus a band. This is the Google Watch that was found. See, I'm a little suspicious. I think Google planted it, personally, because they wanted the attention. But we know a lot about the watch now because this one was left behind in a bar or somewhere, kind of like the iPhone 4. According to 9 to 5, Google cellular version will be wearable. With 300 milliamp hour battery, so they'll be both cellular and non-cellular. It's going to be pretty and round. I like how it looks. With detachable, interchangeable bands, kind of like the Apple Watch.
I think we've gotten numb to just badly designed a UI the Apple Watch is.
I didn't really understand this.
It's terrible. Yeah. Until I did, Twitter Blue did a survey thing where they wanted to ask users about if it was actually good or not. And I'm like, sure, I'll do that. I'll show up. I'll participate in that. And I used the money I got from that to buy Frank an Apple Watch. And my husband is just not good with technologies. He's a PhD in bacterial genetics, smart guy, worked on the coronavirus vaccine, but he does not understand technology at all. And watching him struggle to use this interface really made me go, there's a lot of, you know, potential here in the market for something like this that's actually usable for normal people. Because like just like figuring out your messages, okay, push the button on the bottom, scroll down until, you know, you hit the right app, tap on it, wait for it to load. It's terrible, right?
Can Google do a better job? I mean, part of the problem is the screen is teensy-weensy. I don't know how you make a good UI on that screen. Samsung's done a pretty good job. Their bezel, it turns, and that actually is the foundation for the operating system. Like, to see notifications on the Samsung Watch, you turn the bezel counterclockwise, and it scrolls to the left. You turn it clockwise, it shows you apps on the right. And it just, it's a pretty intuitive thing. I really like it, but Apple does not do that. The only time I touch the watch is to unlock it. Oh, and to do Apple Pay. I do Apple Pay. And apparently Apple thinks I'm exercising right now, which is,
what happens in the home stretch of the pod.
Yeah, suddenly
it feels like you're exercising.
And I'm exercising.
Heart rate, boom.
Yep.
I just don't understand, like, okay, so I had the watch for a bit, never really caught on with me. Can't your phone just do everything? Like, why do you like the watch, Leo?
It can and it can't. I mean, I could on my phone open up Apple Pay, tap the phone. It's a lot easier just to double tap the button and go like this with the watch. The exercise features,
they're pretty good.
Yeah, I'm not going to carry a phone while I'm exercising, but before I go on a walk or before I go to work with my trainer, I will choose the appropriate workout, and it monitors that. It keeps track of that. Is that beneficial? You know, it's the gamification of exercise is probably some value to me. A lot of people pay attention to their rings. We've seen some life-saving benefits in the Apple Watch. It will notify you if your heart rate is abnormally high, especially if you're not doing anything. It will, I was just at a concert, and it will monitor the audio level and warn you if it's above 90 decibels and risks your hearing. So things like that, I think, are kind of cool.
Well, I think the fact
I use the exercise features religiously. I never leave the house without my Apple Watch. It's my favorite thing to use just because I love to work out. I'm for whatever reason, I'm very, very susceptible to the gamification of working out. Like, Peloton has a new product, the Peloton Guide, which is a weight product that I love because it's the exact same thing. Like, can you fill up the meter as you're doing weight training? But I feel like I'm such a freaking niche case for it that I don't think normal people are want to make sure that they've burned X number of calories a day to remind them to go do a second workout. Yeah. I just don't think that's what normal people do.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's gone health is probably helpful to Google's case, because Apple initially, I was reading Trip Mickle's book After Steve
recently. Yes, talk about that. Yeah.
And he talks about it, right? And Apple initially wanted it to be a fashion accessory. If it remained a fashion accessory, Google's screwed. But the fact that it's gone from fashion to health, I think, puts Google in a position to actually start to compete with Apple.
Are you saying that Google can't do fashion?
Yes.
I think yes, you're I am. Right. I think you're exactly right.
Remember the last wearable they did? I'll give you a hint. You wore it on your face.
Oh, God, the Google Glass. Oh, yeah, you're right. Oh.
Yeah.
We called it the nerd's contraceptive device. Because you're never going to get a date when you're wearing that. Google is kind of the classic wash your hair with soap kind of engineering type, right?
Hey, look, if it works, it works.
I feel like Apple pushes this idea that their Apple Watch is like super fashionable, and it's just not.
It's not attractive.
McDonald's.
Yeah.
It's not even attractive. It's so ubiquitous that it's just.
It's everywhere.
It's meaningless. I mean, I have a very nice one that's red with the Milanese loop, and it's nice, but 900 million other people have it, and you're just, it's like saying Dockers are fashion. It's so ubiquitous. Right. It's just not.
Right. So Christina strikes me as a kind of a fashion icon.
Yeah, definitely.
What is her opinion of that?
I mean, she wears it.
Yeah,
but, she has a bunch of the different bands and stuff. But
that's all you can do. She, yeah. Same thing with Renee Ritchie. Just buy 100% hundreds of bands, which, by the way, Apple makes a pretty penny on. If you buy Apple bands, holy cow. Anything else that you'd like to see from Google? They'll certainly talk about Android 13, which is already in the beta. I don't know if they will announce another Pixel Book. I wish they would. They seem to be, and as typical Google, they got bored, and their attention wandered, and they've completely lost track of Chromebooks. I'm sure they'll say something about it. Google has an opportunity to do something with work from home, I think. I feel like the hybrid work is going to be interesting. Speaking of work from home, I've heard numbers as high as 50% of Apple employees are not happy with Apple's plans to bring workers back to the campus, and people are starting to quit, including Apple's chief of machine learning, who explicitly said, "I'm quitting because I don't want this new return to the office policy. I don't want to come back to the office." Wow, the director of machine learning, Ian Goodfellow, has resigned. He was there 3 years. Now, some wag on Twitter probably pointed out, 3 years is telling. That's usually how long it takes to vest your options. So it could well be he's just quitting to spend more time with his money. I don't know. But he did.
I don't think it's probably not great to be a machine learning scientist inside Apple.
Or Google.
You can't talk to your colleagues. I think it's probably better to be a machine learning worker inside Google.
Yeah, if you can
Google.
Keep your job, they keep firing people for not towing the line.
Right.
Goodfellow said, "I believe strongly more flexibility would have been the best policy for my team," in his goodbye note. So director of machine learning in the special projects group, he's moved on. Petitions have been circulated. It's estimated, as I said, that about half of the Apple staff, which is a huge number, say, we don't like this return to office. And apparently a great many of them are willing to quit.
I remember there were complaints. I used to live in Palo Alto, and I got to know a lot of Apple engineers when I lived there. And there were a lot of people that were very frustrated with their very strict policies about, like, working from home when you're sick. They would box them to a couple of days a month, if I remember correctly. If you think, like, I don't even think this is that complicated. The last time I was driving through Cupertino, I couldn't believe how much worse the traffic was than in the decades since I left there, just difficulty getting around. Like, imagine being stuck in that for like 2 hours a day both ways. Why would you want to do that? And I see, like, my own husband, he's been working from home for the entire pandemic. He's not going back to the office. So I think if Apple wants to recruit top people, they're going to have to show some flexibility on this.
Yeah, I don't blame people. Although through the entire pandemic, I've come to work. But I think you get spoiled working in your jammies with the refrigerator right there. And I don't think there's any evidence that you're not getting the same job done, right?
Well, not everybody thinks that way. I think there are CEOs that I've spoken with who want their people in the office. I think that's the wrong perspective. But I can see, we all know, when people are working from home, it's different. Like, some people will work just as hard. A lot of people won't work just as hard. But I just find it interesting that it's Apple, because Apple doesn't let people inside the different divisions speak with each other. There's a great tweet from Benedict Evans. He goes, "News report, Apple insists all staff go back to the office so they can bump into people from other teams in the hallways and discuss what they're working on in informal, unstructured ways." Oh, wait, because they're not allowed to do that. So it is surprising that Apple, out of all companies, is insisting that this happens.
That was
especially
always
because Steve, you can't have that cross-pollination.
That was always Steve Jobs' dream. The story, it may be apocryphal, but the story was that Steve only wanted one bathroom per floor in that giant ring campus because he wanted people to move around and talk to each other and bump into each other and talk, and that Johnny Ive, I think, convinced him that, no, you need more bathrooms, Steve.
Right.
How is
that's
that?
True reality distortion filter was when you believe that your employees can talk to each other about their different projects when you explicitly do not allow them to
you
do
prevent
that.
Them from it. Yeah.
Yeah.
How was that Trip Mikkel book? Everybody seems to like it quite a bit. Did you find it?
I learned a lot about, I enjoyed it. He just came on the pod also. I enjoyed learning a little bit more about Tim Cook as a young person and Johnny Ive as a young person. You know, the stuff when it gets into the company, okay. But like learning a little bit more about where Tim Cook comes from. Like Trip went down to his hometown and actually found like he had said that he had seen a cross burning and there was a deacon from like a nearby church. And basically like the people from Tim Cook's hometown fact check him on that. And there's some things that don't fully add up. So I just found that to be kind of interesting.
Hmm. New York Times reporter, good sources. I talked, he said, to 200 people to write the book. It seemed to be mostly about Tim Cook versus Johnny Ive, and ultimately explained Johnny's leaving, which I think most of us suspected had something to do with Johnny not being happy with the direction Apple was taking. And as an Apple user, as much as I love Johnny Ive's design sense, I'm kind of glad Apple's gotten back to function over form, and I think most Apple users feel the same. In fact, Apple's sales of the Macintosh have jumped. Their quarterly results were very good for the Macintosh, and Apple estimated that 50% of buyers of the new Macintosh computers had never owned a Mac before.
Hmm.
So that is very good news for Apple. PC sales have not been great. AMD itself, though, sales jumped 71% for AMD. Maybe that's more of an indicator that people are looking for budget PCs.
I don't know, Leo. I read that 100% supply chain stuff. Like it is so hard to get the parts to build a PC right now, a graphics card, just the entire bit of it.
Maybe easier to get Radeon chips than it is NVIDIA chips.
100%. Yeah. It's impossible right now with all the cryptocurrency miners.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah. They also have a strong B2B business. And in this past quarter, B2B's businesses tended to fare a lot better than businesses that are catering to consumers.
Interesting.
So I think that bolstered AMD in a big way.
Lisa Su doing a really good job there at AMD.
Very impressive.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Let's take one more break. We're almost done. I have to say that because I think this can be a marathon, and for either one of you, I appreciate your patience. Last week, Cory Doctorow said, "I'll do the show, but I cannot sit for more than 2.5 hours. So you got to keep it short." And I said, "Okay, for you, Cory, absolutely." Our show today brought to you by brand new sponsor. Very excited about him, Policy Genius. I think you might know the name, whether you're graduating from school or planning a wedding, welcoming a baby, switching jobs. It's Mother's Day. It's really time to think about protecting your family's finances. And that's why you need life insurance. I didn't have life insurance until I had kids, but that's when we got life insurance. It can give you peace of mind that if something happens to you, your loved ones will have a financial cushion. But you got to choose the right insurance at the right price. You may have life insurance for your job. We do, but it's not enough. It's not enough. Most people need up to 10 times more coverage to properly provide for their families. Of course, life insurance gets more expensive as you get older. So it's better to start a policy sooner rather than later. And I strongly suggest you go to Policy Genius to do it. A one-stop shop to find the insurance you need at the right price. There's a link at our show page, or you can go to policygenius.com/twit, policygenius.com/twit to get started. In minutes, you will get personalized quotes from a bunch of top companies so you can find your lowest price. That actually can save you. There really can be a big difference in policies. Same policy from different companies can be as much as 50% apart in the cost. You could save 50% or more on life insurance by comparing quotes alone with Policy Genius. And then because it is, you are getting your life insurance via Policy Genius, they have licensed insurance agents. They are required to by law. They'll be there to help you throughout the entire process. So you can ask them questions. They're not selling insurance, though. This is the beauty of it. They're there to help you so you can understand your options and make your decisions with confidence. They don't work for the insurance companies. They work for you. They're not salespeople. They're there to give you the information you need. Policy Genius doesn't add on extra fees. Very important, given our last conversation, they do not sell your info to third parties. They really understand that that privacy is very important to us. Just check their reviews on Google or Trustpilot. Thousands of five-star reviews. You can get coverage in as little as a week. You can get coverage if you want to without medical exams. They've been doing this for quite a while, since 2014. In fact, Policy Genius has now helped 30 million people shop for insurance. They've placed over $150 billion in coverage. And they do it the right way, by giving you information and giving you a choice. Strongly recommend you do this. PolicyGenius.com/twit. Yes, they have home, auto, disability, renter's insurance, and more. They have the full gamut. But today I want to, because it's Mother's Day, you got to take care of your family, you know, and mother or father. And sometimes that means if you got to think about the unthinkable. And if you're not going to be there to take care of them, who is? Policy Genius. PolicyGenius.com/twit. You can get free life insurance quotes. See how much you could save. See how little it'll cost to give you that kind of peace of mind. I was very glad I did it. I'm very glad. You know, Henry's TikTok career is not necessarily going to take him to the moon and back. Do you know that, Brianna, that he has my son's 2 million followers on TikTok? Did you know that? Salt Hank.
Get hungry. So he's just amazing.
He'll make you
talented.
Hungry. Tuesday, yes. He's going to be on Access Hollywood again. For something, yeah, there's something they're doing that's, I think, pretty exciting. It's called, I think, the sandwich head-to-head sandwich competition. He'll be on Access Hollywood on Tuesday with another sandwich maker, another famous sandwich maker, and then the audience will choose which one they like the best. If he makes the vodka parm sandwich, there is no question in my mind. None at all that he will win, but
we all know that if they count the votes fairly, he will win, and if not, rigged. Too soon?
Maybe a bit.
We're gonna come back with a couple of final stories. In fact, a very big victory for people in the Southland. But first, let's take a look back at the week that was. Cameo lays off close to 90, including the CPO, CTO, and VP of marketing.
Why don't you get on Cameo and see how you do? I'd be so curious.
What should I say? Don't you want to have like your trademark thing that you say? Hey, hey, hey.
No.
Previously on Twit. MacBreak Weekly.
Apple's self-service repair is now available.
That equipment, though, Leo.
$216.
I think
we should just get one of these for the studio. It looks like you can make a cup of coffee. Yeah.
iOS today.
Let's talk about webcams. We can make these better. There are ways.
There's two different apps that make using your iPhone as a web camera much easier. It allows you to take the great camera on the back of your device, even on an older iPhone, and use it as a web camera. Have you got a cat on your head, Micah?
Now there's a cat on my head.
Micah has an AI cat on his head. Okay.
Hands-on photography.
The one and only, 49ers photographer, amongst other things, Canon Explorer of Light, Mr. Terrell Lloyd.
Get it right in camera. If it's garbage in, it's garbage out.
That's right.
Inside the camera, do the least amount of post-production work on it. I mean, if you have to, right?
Twit. Tell your boss it's job related.
He'll believe it. She'll believe it. We should have a segment on the show based on the meme, This Is Fine. It's time to play This Is Fine. NVIDIA fined $5.5 million for allegedly, why is it allegedly? If they got fined, we can say they did it, hiding how many gaming GPUs were sold to crypto miners. SEC said you misled investors by reporting a big boost in revenue related to gaming without alluding to the fact that, no, it's not gaming, it's crypto mining. We were just talking about that. The problem is a $5.5 million fine for NVIDIA is nothing. It's the cost of doing business. Intuit paying a little bit bigger fine, $141 million for free TurboTax ads. It weren't free. No, I think $141 million probably stings a little bit more. But again, these companies are making
some... They're the biggest scammers. TurboTax,
yes,
man.
Yes.
I feel so strongly about that one. You know, part of like TurboTax is they came into an agreement with the United States government who wanted to develop their own tax filing software as just like a service to taxpayers to make it easier. And they went to Congress and they said, look, we're going to give you a free version. It's going to be very easy for people to file. It will be open. And then only sophisticated people will need to pay for our full product here. Of course, it never happened. It's just a lie. And then you see this lawsuit. Ooh, it gets me mad. I feel
every
mad.
Year. I don't like this one. I do, yes, my mom's taxes. She's 89. Her taxes are very simple. Every year, I select free. I want the free TurboTax. I end up paying $89 every year, no matter what.
100% the same. This is our broadest point of agreement on the panel, which I'm very excited about, because they deserve the ire, the combined ire of the three of us.
But is $141 million enough, right?
No, do more.
Do
double.
More. Make it hurt. Because what
make
happens?
Make it a billion. I'm
make
okay
it a billion. Because what happens is these companies say, well, it's cost doing business. We made $800 million. I'll give you $144.
89 of those 300 something million people in the U.S., 89 times a good chunk of them, and you can definitely be okay with that $141 million fine.
They will have to suspend their free ad campaign, pay restitution to 4.4 million taxpayers. So maybe this will cost them a little bit.
They should
more.
Have their CEO on video apologizing that as
yes.
The, sorry, America,
groveling.
We ripped you off.
There, you know
we
what?
We knew we were ripping you off, but we did it anyway.
You can't charge these people enough. Humiliate them instead. Make them come on TV and say, we lied.
We did it.
We did it. We lied.
I don't understand why people have to do so much of the heavy lifting here.
Yes,
right? Like many
agreed.
Other countries, the government has a lot of this information already, like my mortgage deduction, right? Get that from the, like, you know how much money I made, you know, my mortgage deductions, like I'm going to have to do some things like, you know, camera equipment for my office to deduct that, right? There will be some legwork.
In Finland, you get a postcard when tax time comes that says, we think you owe this much. If you agree, send us a check.
Right.
That's it. I can't imagine that happening in America. I mean, it's hard enough getting people to pay their taxes.
Yeah, you also got big TurboTax lobbying the government.
Well, that's the real problem.
They threw its corrupt software.
Yeah, so. That's the real problem. You know, the federal government has a free file program. Okay. And then finally, and this is fine.
I love this segment.
I'm going to do this every week now. This is great.
This is fine.
This is when we get a little. This is fine. This is fine. The world's burning, but this is fine.
We're the dog.
And this is fine. Frontier. Oh, man. When Frontier bought all the customers from, I think it was Spectrum, they were leaving the LA area, the LA market. So Frontier bought all the customers. I was getting call after call on the radio show. Just people were, it was awful service. It was terrible. Cory Doctorow's gone off on Frontier about, you know, intentionally keeping their physical plant underpowered and underperforming. FTC said, and this is as of May 5th, it has moved to stop internet service provider Frontier Communications from lying to customers and charging them for high-speed internet it fails to deliver. They were sued last May. It took them a year, but on Thursday they agreed to a settlement, admitting no admission of guilt. With the FTC and district attorneys in Los Angeles County and Riverside County representing the people of California, But it's, again, it's a slap on the wrist. Frontier has to pay $8.5 million to California for investigation and litigation costs. And what do they give customers who were harmed? $250,000 will be distributed to Frontier customers. Oh, you're going to get a check for $1.25.
Whoever negotiated that settlement needs to be that is professional malfeasance, right? There's such
a joke. $8.5 million to California, $250,000 to the consumers.
What a joke. No. That whoever prosecuted that case for the government, they need to go find another line of work, and they probably will.
And they
will probably leave this settlement and go into the
hired Frontier
by the same people.
Yeah, go to work for Frontier. Frontier also has to let customers cancel service at no charge. Yes, Frontier was one of many cable companies that charge you to cancel service.
Ugh.
You can cancel service, but it's going to cost you. What other business in America, if you went to your dry cleaner and said, I'm going to go to the dry cleaner across the street, that'll be $48. What? No other business does that. Cable companies do. So they can't do that anymore. Oh, well, that's good. They will also discount the bills of California customers who have not been notified they're getting DSL service that is much slower than the advertised speed. Much slower. A judge will have to approve this, although the FTC approved it 4-0. It was a slam dunk. And that is our segment. This is fine.
I think sure all these is. Companies should have to come on Twit and grovel before
I'm
you
sorry.
Leo. It should be a judge show, just like Judge Judy, the judge Leo. And then you set the fine.
I
would watch that show.
I'm sorry I did it. I'm sorry. New York City is suing Activision, targeting Bobby Kotick, everybody's favorite CEO. How much did Kotick make when Microsoft bought Activision? A lot. Hundreds of millions of dollars. Of course, he is also being accused of all sorts of malfeasance, including turning a blind eye to harassment.
I think you mean free speech.
Freak speech. That's right.
I'm kidding.
CEO Bobby Kotick knew of sexual misconduct at the company, according to the allegations, but did nothing about it. New York sought access to Activision's books as a basis to sue for allegedly costing the company value. Kotick said no. Anyway, we shall see. We shall see. I think he's going to skate, to be honest with you, and he's going to skate with a lot of money.
He had threats on his own workers. I mean, this is, go read the Wall Street Journal reporting. This is like, there are very few angels in game development. I feel very qualified to say Bobby Kotick is a particularly, I think his actions are extremely, extremely problematic. Culture comes from the top in the game industry. If you look at some of the things that happened under his watch, just to remind your listeners, one of them, you had a woman that was working for a man on this team. He sexually harassed her. She eventually died by suicide. Mm. And then that team passed around nude photos of her after her death for all the men on the team to watch and enjoy looking at. So some truly shocking stuff if you look at it. The fact that I think it's important to note also, this deal has not officially gone through yet. There are regulators that are looking at it. And I can tell you for a fact, there are people looking into the culture of Activision and wonder if it's going to be a good fit for Microsoft that could cause some complications and how this goes through. But overall, just an absolutely terrible tenure, probably the worst tenure of anyone in the history of games. And that's a really high bar.
He ran Activision for 30 years. Microsoft's offering $95 a share. If that does go through, he stands to gain $520 million. Half a billion. You know, the New York State is going after him. Ah, okay. I don't want to end on that note. Let's find something happy to
end. I feel like that should have been in this.
Can we talk about the Apple machinery for fixing iPhones? That is so cool. I love that.
Yeah, we showed a little bit of that in the promo. Apple's self-repair plan has gone into effect. And actually, I think I'm going to give Apple props because they could make you buy hundreds of dollars worth of equipment. Instead, they're going to rent it to you for a week for $49 plus the cost of the part you're going to repair. Now, you do have to get the machine for the device that you're repairing. These machines are very specific. But if you go to Apple's self-service repair store, you can order the parts yourself. I would say you got to know what you're doing. Let's say I want to replace the battery in my iPhone 12 Pro Max. Okay, so the kit, the battery bundle itself, that's $71. But if you return the old battery, you get $24 back. So that's about $50 for the repair. That's not bad. You will have to rent some machinery.
It comes in a couple of really
nicely packed Pelican cases, weighing hundreds of pounds.
Yes.
These are not what? Little. What? Yes, because you're going to need this. It's a battery press.
79 pounds for the one I looked at. And this is what I love about it.
You're going to need this?
Apple, the company that's always talking, we're green. We love the environment, y'all. So our new plan is to ship like 79-pound packages just all around the country constantly. Right?
And you better return it on time or you will owe. It is only $49 to rent it, but yeah, you're going to owe a little bit more if you don't return it. I think it's only 7 days.
Wow, that's cool.
But they pay for shipping.
Screen. I can fix my screen with one of these things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The toolkit comes in cases, then when stacked on top of each other, measure 4 feet high.
What the? Okay,
one maybe case weighs 43 pounds, the other 36 pounds.
Oh, my God.
The UPS driver is not going to like you. Oh, but good news, the cases do have roller wheels to aid in transport.
So you're making the UPS guy literally lug $100 of equipment into your house because you're too lazy to go to the Apple store.
Yeah. And by the way, it is cheaper to bring it to the Apple store, incidentally. You will save
it. It is.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, we got the right to repair.
But you have the. In a way, I feel like this is Apple saying, you asked for it. You wanted it. And this is what it takes. Not easy to do.
You made daddy give it to you.
You made daddy.
Now you have it.
There's a term for that. It's called malicious compliance.
Yes. It's perfect.
Perfect. Perfect. Perfect. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been a very patient and lovely audience, but I think it's time to roll this show up and declare it completed. Alex Kantrowitz, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much. The website is bigtechnology.substack.com. Subscribe to the newsletter. The podcast, is it free? I think it is, yes?
Yeah, free podcast. Big Technology Podcast. It works on every app.
And I must listen this week. Yeah, it's not Spotify special.
That's right. Yeah. But Spotify, if you're listening, $100 million and it's yours.
I always say the same thing. Neither of us.
Hey, look. One day, Leo.
Someday.
We'll get that.
I have that dream.
Spotify. Did you know? So Spotify is now worth 20. I think they actually paid $200 million to Rogan, and they're now worth $20 billion. So a full 1/10 of their valuation went to Joe Rogan.
That's astounding.
Pretty wild.
Oh my God.
I don't, you know, in some ways, I don't mind Joe Rogan getting $200 million. It's Call Her Daddy who got $60 million for one show.
Yeah.
One show a week. That it irks me a little bit. It's just a little, you know, I'm not a teenage woman, so I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it's a wonderful show for the people, for the youngs.
But Leo, great to be on. Thank you for having me. It's really always a pleasure to talk tech with you. And Brianna, I mean, awesome talking with you. Really nice to meet you. This was super fun.
Absolutely. Read your stuff all the time, so it's an honor.
Trip Mickle on the last episode, was Tim Cook the right choice for Apple? This week, the big debate. Big technology.
NFTs, good or bad? Scam or legit? Are they the future of collectibles or business QAnon?
Are you preparing like it's a debate? Like, did you do debate in school? Are you like gathering your facts marshaling your arguments?
Not really.
No.
It's just going to be like me being like, but really?
No,
and
you're
being like,
you're wrong.
Yeah, really. I watched, you know, I did watch Line Goes Up. I mean, Line Goes Up is this amazing YouTube video that like talks about the blockchain and NFTs. And it's one of like the best YouTube videos I've ever watched. So I did take a heck of a lot of notes, and I will come armed with those notes.
I watched a YouTube video and I am ready to debate.
I'm not even ashamed to admit it. It's the truth. I'm ready to roll.
Yeah, that video is so great. I
it's
love
great
that.
Video.
Like, fold
it's a great video.
Videos. And then I'm like, well, what else has this guy done? This is awesome. And then there's like, he has like a 10-hour video series on like analyzing the BDSM in Twilight. I'm like, I'm here for some different content.
Oh, I have to play a little bit of this because.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
Just. Do you have
Wait,
my
Leo, have you watched Line Goes Up? It's so good.
Okay, I can't play it. I wish I could. Just watch it. This is the
spoiler
one with
alert.
All the great quotes. Yeah. They're hysterical.
The line doesn't go up. That's the spoiler.
Yeah,
it doesn't
there's the
go.
Spoiler. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really good stuff. That and the Legal Eagle. Yeah. Then you're set.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Alex. Brianna, we love you. Thank you so much for being here. Your voice is all better. It sounds great.
It's mostly better. I've got a little bit more to heal, but it's a lot better than it has
been. You look great. Things are going well. Tell us about Rebellion Pack.
Rebellion Pack, you know, we have the midterms coming up. We're going to be supporting a lot of candidates.
Now's the time.
This is not,
get out
now
and
is
vote.
The time.
Do not let this stand. I'm sorry.
I mean, this is not a political show, but I would imagine many of your listeners have watched events that have happened this week with some trepidation.
Yes.
If you want to get involved, it's not enough just to vote. You need to either run for office or, you know, donate to candidates or causes.
Should I avoid Act Blue? I feel like Act Blue.
I want to do a whole show with you, Leo, sometime talking about the ways that professional donors misuse your information.
Thank you.
Because
Thank you.
I will go on your show and take a lie detector test that I've never sold any information to anyone and never will.
Good.
But there is a really cavalier attitude in my party and how we treat donors' information, and it is so counterproductive.
Plus,
because
there's dark patterns on the site that get you to do automatic recurring donations. I was donating $1,000 a month for 3 months before I caught
it. Oh, my God.
I was a little upset. You know, I wanted the initial donation. I didn't want the subsequent, but I missed the little checkbox. And it was very upsetting.
We have some practices that are not justifiable, in my opinion. But
donate directly to Rebellion Pack at the website. Donate.
Yes, you can. Yes. You can go to Help the Rebellion and do that. And I promise you, Leo will have words of me if I did this. But we do not sell your information.
Good.
I want to put up just one more quick thing, Leo. If any of your listeners are in Arizona, I have a really good friend of mine, Derek. He's actually a producer for, what's the British car show? The really famous one.
Oh, yeah. But they have a new name.
Oh God, I got four hours of sleep last night because my
basement flooded.
You actually
did remarkably well, given your
thank you. I appreciate
basement.
That. Yeah. No, but he's a friend
Just
of mine.
Say the British car
guy.
Show with Stig.
Yes, the British car
guy.
Top Gear. his mother, unfortunately, is 80 years old. She suffers from dementia. She left the house on Thursday. Has been missing ever since. I've been donating a lot of time working to get people down there to get volunteers for the search and rescue effort. Actually, talking about good use of ad technology, we've been using the technology of micro-targeting ads to help get together people to go down there and basically scour to go hiking to try to go find her. If any Twit listeners are interested in that, please reach out to me. I will happily put you in touch. Obviously, it gets to be 100 degrees in Phoenix. Time is short, so we would really appreciate your
golly.
Help.
So just at Brianna Wu on Twitter.
Yep. Just shoot me a tweet. I'll be happy to point you in the right direction.
Wow. Yeah. That's something to do for Mother's Day.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Kiss your mom. Hug her. Hold her tight. because she's, I hope, still with you. And if not,
I do too.
Remember. Thank you, Brianna. Thank you, Alex. Thank you to all of you who watch and listen. We appreciate it. If you want to watch us do it live, it's always interesting when we're live, by the way. Not quite the same show you're going to get in the final polished edition. You can do it at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC every Sunday evening. The live stream, audio or video, live.twit.tv. After the fact, all of our shows are available at the website, twit.tv. Or on the YouTube channel. Each show has its own dedicated YouTube channel where you can watch the video. We have audio and video of every show. The best thing to do is search for Twit on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to every single darn show. That would be the best thing to do. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you next time. Another Twit is in the can.